Good afternoon, and welcome to Tickling the Belly of the Beast from the heartland of Santa Cruz. This is Janaea, and I'm going to be your hostess today, along with my co-host, Thomas Miller.
Good afternoon,
Say
everybody.
Hi, Thomas. We've got three incredible guests coming on this afternoon, and we're both real excited. The first one is John Parkins, and he is the author of Hoodwinked, And it's an economic hitman reveals why the world financial markets imploded and what we need to do to remake them. And he's well qualified to speak on this topic and turn it around for us. We'll be learning a lot from him. And then in the second hour, we're going to be talking with Jeffrey Grupp about telementation. That's a deep form of meditation. And we'll be learning a lot about that and how to really work with shifting our history and how it controls us. And then from 4 to 5, we'll be speaking with Kenneth Kramer on mysticism and Martin Buber, I and Thou. Can you say a little bit more? He's a dear friend of Thomas's.
Yes, and Ken does a hallowing of the day and bringing the divine into each moment and each potentially into each meeting we have with the other, being the other person.
Wonderful. Oh, I'm excited. Well, I believe we have John on the phone now. Let me just double check that. John, are you on the phone? Whoops. John?
Yes, I'm here. Thank you.
Oh, wonderful. Welcome to Tickling the Belly of the Beast.
Well, my pleasure. Thanks for having me on, Cynthia and Thomas.
You're welcome. And this is Thomas. He's also here with us. And Mr. Perkins refers to himself largely as a former economic hitman. He's seen the signs of today's financial meltdown before, the subprime mortgage fiasco, the collapse of the banking industry, and of course, the rising unemployment rate. He was on the front lines of monitoring and helping create these very events that were once just confined to the third world. From 71 to 81, he worked for the international consulting firm of Charles T. Maine, where he was the self-described economic hitman. He is also the author of the New York Times bestseller, Confessions of an Economic Hitman, and The Secret History of the American Empire. And why I love this book so much, Hoodwink, is it's refreshing and a welcome change from so many books that we've seen on the market about the economic collapse. He really goes to the root of what's happened, and he calls it predatory capitalism. The fact that the corporations have a lot of the power and control over the capital. And he's going to be discussing that. But to begin with, Mr. Perkins, can you talk a little bit about describe to us what an economic hitman actually is?
Yes, I'd be happy to, Cynthia. And please call me John.
Sure.
My dad was Mr. Perkins, and he's dead. I don't want to be confused with him right now. You know?
Sure.
I think it's fair to say that we economic hitmen have created the world's first truly global empire. And it's the first empire in history that's been created primarily without the military. And the way that we do this, well, actually we work many ways, but perhaps the most common is that we will identify a third world country with resources our corporations covet, like oil, and arrange a huge loan to that country from the World Bank or one of its affiliated organizations. And yet in the end, that money never actually goes to the country. Instead, it goes to our own corporations to build big infrastructure projects in that country. So they go in and they build things like power plants or industrial parks that serve a few rich people, but not the majority of the people at all, because the majority of people can't afford electricity. Industrial parks don't hire many people, really. But the majority of the people, the average citizen, is left holding this huge debt. And, of course, most of this debt went to paying our own corporations to come in and construct these projects. But this debt is so big that the country can't repay it. And so at some point we go back and we say, since you can't repay your debt, give us a pound of flesh. Sell your oil real cheap to our oil companies, or vote with us on a critical United Nations vote, or allow us to build a military base on your soil, something along these lines. And then in the few cases where we economic hitmen fail, where we cannot corrupt these leaders into accepting these loans, and I talk in Hoodwinked about how I failed with the democratically elected president of Ecuador, Jaime Roldós, and also the head of state of Panama, Omar Torrijos. When we fail, the jackals go in. And these are people who either overthrow governments and coups or assassinate their leaders. Both Roldós and Torrijos of Ecuador and Panama were assassinated because I failed to bring them around to corrupt. They would not be corrupted. And where the military, where the jackals also fail, then the military goes in as a last resort.
Our military to finish the coup.
Right.
And, you know, what's so horrifying, too, is the people have no say in what is going on.
Well, we actually have a lot more say than we realize. We just don't bother to say it.
No, I mean the people in the countries that were overthrown.
Oh, in the countries. No, we do here in the United States. We could put an end to this if we would just decide to. But the people in the countries where this is happening usually have no say. Because in the past, at least 9 times out of 10, our CIA was responsible for putting their government in power and keeping it there. We often were in charge of this, and we supported dictatorships, or we corrupted the leaders so much that they kept their people in the dark. And there have been many exceptions to that. I mentioned Roldos of Ecuador and Torrijos of Panama. There was Arbenz of Guatemala, who was also overthrown in a coup.
Yes.
And Mossadegh of Iran, and there have been a number of exceptions. Yeah, but and usually where you have those exceptions, if it's in countries with resources that our corporations covet, those leaders do not last.
And what's so sad is the resources, the rich resources of these nations are extracted, and then the corporations make so much money, and the people end up losing their social services, their right to health care, education. And it's what's happening here. So what were the signs that you saw here?
I think it's fair to say, Cynthia, that, you know, the economic hitmen have come home to roost.
Yeah.
And in a way, we all have to take responsibility for this because, you know, we in the United States have been turning a blind eye to what's going on. You know, we've been saying basically to the big corporations, listen, you know, we want cheap tennis shoes, and if you have to have slave labor in sweatshops in Indonesia to give us those and cheap T-shirts, we'll just look the other way.
Mm.
And we want cheap petroleum for our cars, and if that means you have to destroy Amazon rainforest in order to bring us cheap petroleum, we'll look the other way.
That's true.
We've done this, and we sort of said, you know, just don't do it in our backyard. And now it's come home to roost. And many of these similar techniques are being used in the United States. Perhaps the most easily understood one is it goes along with the same thing that I just described of putting countries into a position where they're heavily indebted to us and therefore become our slaves. Is the way that Wall Street and the banks and the loan companies have dealt with homeowners. You know, it wasn't very long ago that they would go in and convince somebody that they could afford a $500,000 home when, in fact, they could only afford a $300,000 home.
Yeah.
But the banks and the loan companies would say that, you know, that your $500,000 home will be worth $1 million in 5 years. So, you know, tighten your belt a little bit for a few years, and you're building a huge asset base here. Go ahead and make the extra payment. Get a $500,000 home instead of a $300,000 home. It'll be worth so much more in just a few years. And then the bottom fell out of the market, and these people couldn't make their payments. Their home now is only worth $200,000. And the banks actually are going to take the homes back and resell them once again. And meanwhile, the people who are losing their homes are also in an extremely precarious position. They are not going to go out on the streets and protest. They're going to be damn careful. They want to get other jobs. They want to get another home. They want to stay clean, so to speak. It's a very similar thing. When you make people heavily indebted to you, whether it's an individual human being or a country, you suddenly basically shackle them. You've got them.
And they've been hoodwinked, too. The media has not done a good job about mortgage flexible mortgages with the adjustable interest rates.
Well, you know, in your opinion, the media hasn't done a good job, but if you happen to own the media, like General Electric that owns NBC, and if you happen to own, you know, Time Warner, et cetera, or any of the other, there's basically six big media corporations that control the mainstream media, and they're all owned by big corporations. they think the media's done a great job because it's hoodwinked us. It's kept us in the dark. So from that standpoint, you know, they've done a good job.
Were encouraged not to tell the truth. I mean, many of them were making hefty profits with each mortgage that they sold. So we are responsible, yet we're not getting the truth often, the whole truth. And I think people are finally waking up to the control that the corporations do have over us. Our government has been hijacked, too, to a large extent. And I am hopeful that this will turn around as well. But it's going to take a lot of accountability. And individuals hide behind corporations. Their charters are such that I loved in your book your description of, at one point, the charter of corporations. They had to be accountable to the community. And how that's changed.
Yeah, the first 100 years of the history of the United States, no corporation could get a charter unless it proved that it was going to serve a public interest. Charters lasted on average for 10 years, and then the corporation had to go back and prove it had served the public interest and would continue to do so. That all ended in the 1880s when the Supreme Court basically decided that corporations had all the rights of individuals.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly all of that changed. The chartering process totally altered. But I think we really need to go back to something like that. In Hoodwinked, I talk about five different steps that we can all take, or each one of us can take any one of those, or all five, to move us into a new situation. And I think, you know, it's really important to understand that we can return to a situation where corporations are not only held responsible, but are held to the standard of being good citizens. If they're going to be citizens, let them be good citizens. Let them have to be held up to the same sorts of standards that you and I as citizens are held up to. You can't rob, plunder, steal, and cheat and get away with it.
And I believe ultimately if we demand that, that will turn around. But right now there seems to be a climate of encouraging taking advantage and making as much money as you can and profit at all cost without looking at the hidden, as you write about in your book, the hidden costs of doing business that's not looked into, the social costs, the environmental costs that aren't added into accounting.
Yeah, I believe that it's that people, there's two things going on at least, that one is there's a lot of fear that if you do protest or talk against the system as it is, that you'll be ostracized in some way, shape, or means. And then that aspect of making the most money out of the situation. I just listened to a rundown on the health reform bill that's up in Congress, and the insurance companies, some mucky muck in the insurance company being quoted as saying that there's $1 trillion of windfall here to be made. And it's just so how do we change that whole mindset?
Well, we have to talk a lot about it more and get people more involved, get people to stop spending so much time watching Super Bowls and sitcoms and American Idol. All the hoopla leading up to and through the Super Bowl, it made me think, what if we put just a tenth of that effort into people really trying to understand what's going on in the world? And, you know, this is an incredibly important time in world history. There's never been a time like this. For the first time in human history, we're all on this planet confronted by the same crises. Never happened before. You out in California had earthquakes, and Florida had hurricanes, and Haiti had earthquakes too, and Indonesia had tsunamis. It didn't really affect each other very much, but today every one of us, every human being on this planet, every sentient being on this planet is confronted by the crises that are arising out of global climate change, overpopulation, resources that are diminishing at accelerating rates, and prices of essentials like food and fuel that are increasing at accelerating rates. These are things that we're all facing, every single one of us.
Yes.
And for the first time in human history, and this has only been the last couple of years, we're all communicating with each other through cell phones and the Internet. Everybody on this planet, practically, is connected.
Mm-hmm.
And that's amazing. That's
it is.
Truly amazing. And, you know, we have to realize that I have a 2-year-old grandson.
Oh.
We have to recognize that he can't possibly hope to grow up in a sustainable and just world unless every child born in Asia, in Latin America, in Africa, in the Middle East, has that same expectation that it's realized.
Yes.
And this has never been true before. Never. You know, it used to be that Santa Cruz could take care of Santa Cruz, or perhaps it expanded out to California, or maybe even the United States, and to heck with the rest of the world. But today, we are so interrelated, so integrated, mm-hmm. so interdependent, that we must recognize that we've reached a new stage in human development, that we cannot have homeland security until we recognize that the whole planet is mm-hmm. our homeland, in fact.
And our impact is so far-reaching. You write about, terrorism. You talked about, you were speaking with an elder from Somalia and the pirates and how they came into being. And I believe he said, well, you're destroying our land, our water. We can no longer fish. What are we to do? We have hungry children. And then that impacts our vessels, our seamen. You know, it's so true. We are all interconnected intimately. Things come home to roost. One child hurts. Ultimately, we all hurt. People are waking up around Haiti, although I wonder about the money that's being thrown into the country. I just pray that it's going to the people. Sometimes I'm a little suspicious.
Mm-hmm. Well, it won't, ultimately. I mean, in the short run, typically, this is what happened in Asia with the tsunamis, is that in the short run, a lot of money does go down. Water's provided, blankets, tents, food, first aid, and that's very good. But then the real aid money to rebuild the country,
mm-hmm.
Rather than rebuilding small fishing boats for the Haitian fishermen,
yes.
the money will go to building big fishing fleets that serve U.S. agribusinesses that sell fish on the world market. And instead of helping small farmers, it'll help the Monsantos and the Doles and the Chiquitas. And instead of helping mom-and-pop organizations rebuild their restaurants and bed and breakfast in the area, it'll go towards the big hotel chains. And that's been typical. We've taken tremendous advantage of these shocks, these crises around the world to further American business. And in the case of Haiti, of course, building a huge military complex there, which is a direct threat to Venezuela and the other 9 Latin American countries who voted in recently leaders who are saying, we don't want to be exploited anymore. We won't put up with this anymore. So a big military base in Haiti will really threaten these people.
That's discouraging. I wonder who we can give to then. If we know where we can give our money, if there are any organizations that truly work to give it to the people.
Yeah, the short-term ones, like what I talked about, first aid, the ones you're giving to probably right now, fine. But it's what I'm talking about is when USAID, U.S. Agency for International Development,
and they get
and
a big
World,
chunk.
World Bank and all the other development organizations, using our tax dollars, you don't give money to them directly. You give money, you pay taxes, and the tax money goes to those organizations, which then will hire big multinational corporations to build these mammoth projects that will serve big corporations and very wealthy people, not the average person in Haiti.
So much of our shackling is due to corporations. And how would you like to see them define themselves? Or what would a good citizen corporation mission statement look like?
We have to define them, I think, Cynthia. It comes back to we the people. We're not victims. We don't have to look the other way. All of this predatory capitalism, as I call it, it's a very new phenomenon. It's only been around since the 70s. And it really took off in 1980 when Ronald Reagan became president and embraced the economics of the Milton Friedman from the Chicago School of Economics.
Yeah.
And this was diametrically opposed to the previous theory, which was expounded by John Maynard Keynes. And Keynes's form of capitalism was fairly compassionate. And it said, CEOs of corporations are not should not be above the law. They, you know, they've got to be watched too. There's got to be some regulations on these guys because, after all, they're just human too. They, you know.
And they did work. The regulations did.
And they worked. But when Reagan embraced Milton Friedman, and incidentally, every president since has, including Obama. This is not. I'm not picking on the Republicans here. Reagan was the first, and Margaret Thatcher came along at the same time, and then basically the whole world embraced.
Clinton did a good job too.
Absolutely,
and this is and Obama's continuing in their footsteps.
Predatory capitalism, and it's really the three defining principles to predatory capitalism, to Friedman's form of economics, and the first is that the sole responsibility of business is to maximize profits, regardless of the social and environmental costs. You don't pay attention to those things. You just maximize profit. The second one is businesses should not be regulated because that gets in the way of making profits. And the third is that everything should be run by private business. Privatize everything. Privatize the jails, privatize the school system, privatize the military, and what we're seeing happen in Afghanistan today. And these three principles combined have created a very unsustainable, very dangerous, very unstable world that we live in today. So where we need to move is beyond that and look at, you know, let's redefine what corporations are supposed to do. And we can do this in the marketplace by only buying from corporations that follow a new goal, and that goal should be something like go ahead and make profits, but only while being socially and environmentally responsible. Make profits, but only within the context of creating a sustainable, just, and peaceful world for my grandson, which means for every child on this planet, ultimately. And so let's set that as a standard. And if your listeners only buy from corporations that are committed to creating a sustainable, just, and peaceful world, and send emails to those corporations, and send emails to the corporations like Nike and so many others that are not committed to that.
But
that
claim to. It's
hiring
tricky.
Slave. Excuse me?
They do claim to be.
Who?
Nike. Environmentally conscious.
Nike's made some big improvements environmentally, but it still has terrible sweatshops in many places in the world. Most pronouncedly in Indonesia, and you know, there's a lot of people watching that. There's no question. They've in fact gotten worse in the last 5 years.
So voting with our dollars, essentially.
Yes, it's very important. I think in some respects, it's more important than the political polls. The marketplace is democratic if we choose to make it such. And we've had a huge impact. You know, we got rid of apartheid in South Africa and other places because we boycotted the companies that supported it. We get companies to clean up terribly polluted rivers, ones that were on fire.
The Boston
in Ohio.
Harbor, where I'm from, and you are.
Where's
the Boston Harbor was cleaned up.
Right. And getting rid of aerosol cans that were destroying the ozone layer, and recently taking trans fats out of food.
Yes.
And antibiotics out of chickens. Our vote at in the marketplace is very, very powerful. And I think now we need to ratchet that up a notch and say, we're only going to vote for companies that are committed to a much bigger goal, which is to be socially and environmentally responsible, to truly be green.
In a way, it seems that would be self-serving for the corporations themselves, and that if the heads of the corporations could be flipped to really look into seven generations, and who are they going to sell their goods and services to if the whole system tanks? It's in corporations' self-interest, actually.
But then they just go to other countries and plunder.
But, I mean, I'm talking
about
the whole system tanks.
And it is.
Well, yeah, that's...
Yes, and you don't even have to look to seven generations. Just look to next year. Instead of the quarterly income statement, look at, you know, let's look out a year ahead, 2 years, 3 years, 5 years. It'd be nice if we looked to seven generations, but in fact, they don't even look beyond the next quarter right now.
Right.
And we need, you know, we need. You know, when I went to business school in the 60s, late 60s in Boston, my professors used to teach me, and this reflects Keynesian economics. My professors used to say, you know, when you become CEO of a company, understand that your job is to long-term sustainability of that country, of that company.
Right.
Yeah.
Not windfall profits. Your responsibility is to your employees, to your suppliers, to your customers as well as to your stockholders. It's not just to your stockholders, and you know what else? You are responsible to make sure that your corporation is a good community citizen, takes care of the community, and that was the prevailing concept in business schools up until the late 70s, and especially after Reagan embraced Milton Friedman in the 80s, and then that all changed.
Reagan embraced what in the 80s?
Milton Friedman
economics as opposed to Keynes.
Okay, I got it.
It changed dramatically, I know, and deregulation came in, mm-hmm. and you created, or you started a energy company when you first when deregulation started, and you had some initial success, but weren't you bought out by a larger firm and sort of framed to do that?
Yeah, we were. We had incredible success. My company that I owned and ran produced the first plant in the United States that burned waste coal.
Wow.
These huge mounds of terrible self-igniting coal that dotted the landscape of Pennsylvania. And we were the first plant that actually burned coal without producing acid rain.
That's amazing.
So in those days, we weren't even thinking of carbon dioxide. This is in the 80s. But we were very concerned with acid rain. And I talk about it in the book, it did a lot of other very amazing things. It was a great plant. In fact, it changed the laws in this country. After that, after we proved that you could do it, laws were written that nobody could build a coal plant again that produced acid rain. Those laws are still
on the books. I remember that.
Excuse me?
I remember reading that, but I didn't know that you were the originator of that. And would you want to speak a little bit about Dream Change and the Pachamama Alliance? And after you left the main company, you went back to Ecuador and started working with the indigenous people whose land the corporations had pretty much destroyed.
Right, yeah. I mean, I've been very involved. I was a Peace Corps volunteer in the Amazon before I was an economic hitman. And afterwards, I went back. I was an economic hitman for 10 years, and then I had this energy company for 10 years, and which was dedicated to producing environmentally beneficial electricity in this country. And then I went back to the Amazon, and the people I'd been with in the Amazon, the indigenous people known as the Shuar, I said, you know, I know your forests are being destroyed. I want to help you save your forests. And they, in their typical way, said, well, that's nice, but if you want to save our forest, don't come here and try to change us. We're not destroying the forest. You are. Your lumber companies, your oil companies, your cattle companies are destroying these forests. And more than anything, it's your dream. It's the dream that you in the North have had of big factories and lots of cars. And that's a dream that's come true, and it's turned out to be a nightmare because it's destroying the planet. So you've got to re-dream a dream. You've got to come up with a new dream. Change the dream. You get your people. And so I came back to the United States and formed a nonprofit called Dream Change, which is all about changing the dream. We do workshops. We do a lot of workshops. You can go to our website, dreamchange.org. This is back in the early 90s, and this organization is still thriving. And out of that organization grew another one called the Pachamama Alliance, which now is, I think, in 60 countries. We have something like 30,000 facilitators teaching workshops on awakening the dreamer programs. And we're also working, we send out $2 million every year to help the indigenous people protect their forests. And that's under Pachamama.org, so P-A-C-H-A-M-A-M-A. .org and dreamchange.org. I have a lot more information on both of those organizations, which I'm still on the board of and very proud of both of them.
And that's Pachamama.org and dreamchange.org. And don't you lead, or some individuals lead, tours around the world?
I just came back in December. I took a group of about 27 people. I have a co-facilitator, Lynn Roberts, who wrote the book Shamanic Reiki and has been a director of Dream Change for a number of years. We took a group of 27 people to the Maya lands of Central America, Yucatan, and Guatemala to the sacred sites, and studying the go to my website, johnperkins.org, and that'll take you to those two, and also show you where I'm speaking at. In fact, I'm speaking at your neighborhood.
Yes, Walnut Creek, you said.
Yeah, next week. And
wonderful.
Yeah, I'm on a pretty extensive tour, so you know, if people are looking for where they could, I'd love to meet some of your listeners, Cynthia and
Great.
Thomas. And I will be in Walnut Creek on February 22nd.
And where in Walnut Creek will you be?
It's at the the Mount Diablo Unitarian Universalist Church.
Mount Diablo Unitarian Universalist Church.
Yeah, and this is sponsored by the Mount Diablo Peace and Justice Center.
Great.
It's 7 p.m. Monday, February 22nd, and it says here there's a reception at 5:30 p.m. I don't know what you have to do to be part of that reception, but I guess you could contact.
Is there a phone number?
Or the church.
Mount Diablo Unitarian Universalist Church. I will get the phone number and announce that too.
Okay, that would be great. Yeah.
And that's at 5:30. So 5:30.
Oh wait, here I see it right here. I think this is the right number.
Okay.
925-933-7850.
Great.
925-933-7850.
And that's February 22nd. What night of the week is that?
It's a Monday.
It's a Monday. Great.
Yeah, that's a beautiful church, good setting with Mount Diablo looming overhead. I was there years ago for a nonviolence training prior to a Lawrence Livermore lab blockade with Starhawk. It'd be great to hear you speak there.
Yes.
My predisposition in these kind of encounters with authors of who are discussing what's going on and what to do about it. What can an individual on a daily basis, aside from voting with our dollars, you talk about changing the dream of our culture.
I love that.
How do we change that dream?
Mm-hmm. You know, I think, and I talk about five different approaches in Hoodwink, and I thank you for asking, Thomas. One of them, obviously, is voting it with our shopping or not shopping. And another point on that is we have to let people know. You got to send an email to Nike and tell them why you're not buying from them, because it's not enough to just not buy, but email makes it so easy. Something else I think that's very important is to look at who our icons are. Who do we devote our time honoring and worshiping, you know? Who do we want our children to emulate? And if you look at the magazines on any magazine rack, you'll see that we're bringing our children up to emulate people like Donald Trump. You know, I mean,
I
my
know.
God, who wants to emulate him? Or Jack Welch, the former CEO of GE,
yes.
Who actually was a robber baron, laid off a quarter of the people at GE, fought every way he possibly could to keep from having GE pay to clean up the Hudson River, which is terribly polluted. This guy was a robber baron, and yet he's held out as some sort of a hero. And many others. I mentioned a lot of the people in the book. Instead, you know, let's set our heroes to be, you know, the people who found organizations like Rainforest Action Network, Randy Hayes out in your neck of the woods, or, you know, Conservation International or the Nature Conservancy or Sierra Club, or people who are building businesses and stores and that are truly green. Every year, San Francisco hosts a green festival. I speak at it usually.
Yes.
And you'll have 50,000 people pass through this huge marketplace, which is filled with entrepreneurs that are really dedicated to making good products that are serving the earth and serving people and are being made in a green way. So let's put those people on the cover of Time and Fortune. Let's have a Fortune 500 list of the 500 people who are doing the most to create a better world for our children and grandchildren, not the ones who are buying the big yachts and private planes. We don't want our kids to emulate that. So
no.
We need to redefine who our heroes are. And, you know, let's celebrate the sports heroes who are really taking a stand to do good. I hate to even mention, you know, Tiger Woods. But I was so struck by the fact that here's a man who for years made hundreds of millions of dollars off a company, Nike, that was hiring slave laborers, not even hiring, that was using slave laborers in sweatshops in Indonesia. And Tiger Woods never spoke up against this. It was never criticized.
No.
for making all this money off the backs of slaves. And what he was criticized for was doing something that, in my opinion, is nobody's business except him and his families. But the fact that he was making all this money off slave labors is all of our business. So let's watch out for who we put on pedestals. Mm-hmm. And in that same vein of talking about the Green Festival, another thing we need to do is truly create a new economy,
yes.
One that where we make things for each other that mm-hmm. are really helping to create a better future for this planet, for every life form on this planet. Let's focus on that. So, and all of us can participate in this by buying things that only help the planet, by moving in the direction of honoring the people mm-hmm. that do this, and let's insist that our tax dollars go toward these things. We have a lot of control if we just start voicing ourselves. I'm so struck by the fact that so much of our tax dollars today goes to supporting killing the military. What if we took a small percentage, even to begin with, of the military budget, paid the same companies, General Dynamics, Raytheon, the companies that are currently making weapons of destruction, mm-hmm. and instead hire the brilliant minds in those companies to create technologies and equipment that will clean up the terribly polluted rivers of Africa and Central America yes. and South America, and the terribly polluted air and the terribly polluted land? Our agribusinesses have destroyed much of the land in Central America. I was just there just a couple of weeks ago. And the land there has been destroyed, but it can be cleaned up. Let's hire these companies to come up with technology to do that, and let's use another percentage of our – I'm sorry to keep going like this, but let's use another percentage of our military budget to hire Monsanto and Dole and Chiquita to, instead of doing what they're currently doing, which is obnoxious, to instead come up with ways – for starving people in Africa to more efficiently grow crops and store their crops and transport them locally so they mm-hmm. can feed themselves. Let's create a whole new economy. So we the people can put those three things I just talked about, you know, consumer responsibility, mm-hmm. who do we worship, who do we put on pedestals, who do we put on the covers of our magazines, and who and let's really work to creating an economy and supporting an economy that truly does beneficial things around the world.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And if we had a website that we could go to with these ideas, as well as what the corporations are involved in, if you're considering a purchase, you can click onto a website and get that information immediately. What if there is something?
Well,
presently.
Dream Change has a lot of that information. We have a lot of links.
Oh, great.
There are various different places that you can go and check out the you know, sort of the life cycle of products. Having said that, I will say that the information is scanty around the world. I mean, it's incomplete. This is something that really needs to be done, and maybe one of your listeners is an entrepreneur who can come up with a system to really do that. I know several people who are working on the idea of having every product have a barcode, and you could scan it with your cell phone, and it would tell you the life cycle of that product, who made it, whether they were paid honestly, where the resources came from, and what happens at the end. Does it get recycled? What happens at the end?
Oh, that's brilliant.
We don't have that yet, but imagine, you know, if every product kind of had that information the way today food products have to have information about the number of calories, the number of fats, the number of, you know, protein and fiber, et cetera. That's right on the label. Let's start labeling much more extensively on all of our products. Maybe one of your listeners can push that. I'd really like to see that happen. But in the meantime, there is a lot of information out there, and a good place to start is the Dream Change website.
That's a great idea. That way, when one is sitting on one's lawn furniture, you can think about who made the chair you're sitting in, instead of thinking about the nebulosity of who made the chair you're sitting in. But the other thing that I get that could be a good portion of what you're talking about, or an outcome of it, is if corporations did take on responsibility for more than simply the bottom line immediate being made money. It could serve our young people, and because some of the messes that we've created are messes that are going to take longer than one generation to clean up. And if our young people, I think in a lot of ways, one of the, they're disheartened. And if they could identify with a corporation that, in all sense of the word, is immortal, then they could, you could know that, okay, here's a corporation that's actually working to fix these things like starvation, not just starvation of humans either, mind you, but starvations of many different species.
Right.
And here's some place where I can put my energy instead of having a good time on the ride down, which I think is the kind of people that you're talking about that we tend to emulate.
And, you know, I think, Thomas, that's such an important thing that you're saying, because I know a lot of executives, and I personally don't know any that want to see Florida sink beneath the ocean. Or you know, the ones that I know are all very decent people with children and grandchildren who want a better world.
Mm-hmm.
But they've been following our advice, which is basically, as I said earlier, you know, sell me cheap T-shirts, sell me cheap petroleum, and if that means destroying the Amazon or having sweatshops in Indonesia, I don't want to know anything about it. And they've kind of gone along with that. But when and I think at the top of a number of corporations, we do have sociopaths. We saw that at Enron, people just don't give a damn.
They tend to rise to the top, unfortunately.
Well, they do. They do, because they don't give a damn. And I think Phil Knight is one, for sure. But there's a lot of good people in Nike under Phil Knight. I do mean to pick on Nike, because it's one of the worst.
Mm-hmm.
And it spends so much money on hiring these athletes and paying off schools and then doing terrible things to people in the sweatshops that it has in Central America and in Asia and in Africa and other places. And we really need to not be blind to that, not try to get this warm, cozy feeling that, oh, my God, you know, maybe Nike's not so good, but I really like their hats. No, they're a rubber baron organization. Don't put up with it.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of other companies like that, too. And I think at the top of many of these organizations, we have sociopaths, but the people under them are not that way.
That's true.
They're the ones that we need to reach, and at some point they will be taking over these organizations. And we really and they want something better, and they want to hear it from us, though. We have to tell them that we want something better. We've got to pressure them into into understanding that and moving in that direction.
And
you know, it's always been we the people who had to do it.
Always. Well,
and you're talking about changing the dream of our culture. Doing some reading recently about the clash between the European cultures and the indigenous cultures here on Turtle Island, and that we need to change our dream, because the dream that we had and we still have is the measuring people's status by money and material goods, occupation, wealth, and clothing. And the indigenous folk, it was about how many gifts you could give, and your social capital, and deference to age. And,
right.
And if we could, and I mean, that's the stuff that you can't buy. You can't buy social capital. Well, you could argue about that one, but you can't buy social capital.
And it's how many people you know, how many you give to, your richness and relationships.
And if that's the dream, then we could start taking care of things differently.
You know, I'm curious. You said you were just in Central America, and we hear a lot about 2012 coming up. And what do you know about their prophecy?
Well, I've been working with it since the 60s, and I've spent a lot of time with Mayan shamans over the past 40 years. It's been 40 years, I guess it is. Yes, my God, I didn't realize how old I am. I was in Costa Rica and I celebrated my 65th birthday teaching down there at an institution. Then I was teaching about shamanism.
But so and, young at heart with wisdom.
Yeah. Well, you know, the Mayans and I just was down there, as I said, working with a number of Mayan shamans and doing fire ceremonies with them and other rituals. They believe that you know what, on December 21st, 2012 is when, from their standpoint, the sun passes through the center of the Milky Way. It's an important astrological date for them, just a day. And they say, you know, it's this whole period that we're going through, which is a period of tremendous opportunity for transformation. And they talk about, there's a mythological, the Popovul, which is their equivalent of the Bible. It's an actual written book, you know. It's different, it's hieroglyphics rather than our kind of alphabet, but it's a written book.
Yeah.
And it talks about Seven Macaw, who was a mythological leader who was very exploitative, abusive, greedy, materialistic. And
oh, that's the United States. Oh, dear. Their other neighbor.
Right. And Seven Macaw was killed by the twin heroes, and his head was put into this basket, which is the equivalent of the sun moving into the center of the Milky Way. And that's why the state's so important to them. And replaced by Wanapu, who was a leader who was very compassionate, believed in cooperation, was a very spiritual leader. And so what they're saying is that day of the head passing into the basket, which is December 21st, 2012, symbolizes this time when we have the potential to move from a very exploitative era into a much more compassionate era. And they say if we don't do that, things are going to go very wrong. They're already starting to go wrong, but they're going to go very wrong. Now, I've never heard any prophecies that resemble, you know, the movie 2012 at all.
Oh, that was so...
total collapse.
Yes.
But what they say is that, or a lot of them say, and none of them say exactly the same thing.
Doom and gloom.
But what a lot of them say is that those of us who are vibrating at higher levels are the only ones, the higher levels of consciousness, who are more aware of what's going on, are the only ones that will really walk the earth after 2012. They don't really expound upon what that means or what those that are not more aware will be doing after 2012. But I think the message is clear that we all need to become more conscious. You know, if you want to walk the earth after 2012, become more aware. Listen to this radio program more.
Learn what it is to be sustainable, to really walk on the land and listen to it and care for it.
Exactly.
And its people, our brethren, the animals, the two-legged, the winged.
We're
all related. And you know that more. You know it in your cells. Can hear it from what you're sharing with us. And that's a transformative prophecy of beauty. That's so positive. And that's what I love about your book. It is very positive, and it's not pie in the sky. It's based on facts. You've seen it. You've observed changes. You've witnessed them. You're carrying that dream. And you've created corporations. And you're not saying get rid of capitalism. You're saying it can be democratic and it can work for the people.
And
beautifully.
And
it's concrete. Yeah. Practical applications.
Yeah, and feel the beauty that's around us. You know, before I get on this telephone with you, I was out walking the land. Near me is a forest that I love to walk in. And this afternoon, I'm on the East Coast, so it's 3 hours ahead of you. And it was bright daylight. I'm in Florida also. And I'm walking, I'm actually kind of jogging on the land, and I hear this owl, and I kind of followed her and the sound, and I ended up under the tree that she was sitting in. She's looking down at me, and I'm looking up at her, and then we had this exchange, and it was very, very powerful. It was just so beautiful, you know, I felt it so strongly. And then she flew off, and I resumed my jogging, and I went around this corner in the woods and came around another bend, and there she was again, and the tree was right over me. And this time I stopped, and we stood and we looked at each other for a while. This time she didn't fly away, but I continued jogging, so I left her this time.
But, maybe
you
she's
know,
still
things
gone.
Like that are so special, and I feel so deeply honored. And I live in a pretty urban area, but there is this forest. There's parks everywhere, no matter where you live. You can feel the earth. You know, you can feel it even if you're living on the 50th story of a skyscraper. That's earth too. All of our buildings are made out of earth. If you think about it, you can really feel that. And I think we need to get more in touch with it. That is part of the higher level of consciousness.
Mm-hmm. Well, Thomas and I participate in a lot of Native ceremonies around here, sweat lodges, and I go to Sundance, and we're so fortunate here. We have a lot of large parks, federal land and state land, so we can hike in the redwoods. That's why I moved out here. I'm from Boston originally, too. And just recently, I was at a wonderful place, sacred land, called Painted Rock, and there were old indigenous paintings. And I walked in, and immediately two ravens flew out and flew over me, and one darted down as if he was checking me out. And I said, "Oh, can I sit here?" And one just kind of hovered low, kind of low, and the other one kept circling above me, and I said some prayers, and then I walked away, and one kept flying above me as if to say either come back or goodbye. Thank you. I felt like I had really come in a good way, and those experiences are just so heartfelt. I live for those.
Yeah.
And the one thing that we can always get in touch with is the sky, because we change the surface of the earth a lot. The clouds, the coloration given by Father Sun, that's something we can tap in even in the Costco parking lot. And
yes.
And always the earth below the feet. But I've been thinking about some of the things that you've been talking about seem to necessitate being, if not fearless, at least brave, changing life patterns. And one of the things lately I've thought about is how can we encourage bravery or courage in our children and in ourselves? And it strikes me that if we can make the identification with ourselves as spiritual beings and not just as the individual 70-year lifespan, that we're part of a larger entity and representatives of that entity, that way we wouldn't be so attached to how things may work out, or maybe we'd be more trusting that things are going to work out.
Mm-hmm. I think you're right. Yes, and to realize that, there's really nothing more rewarding, nothing more fun than taking a few risks to create a better world, and enjoy it. You know, it doesn't have to be really solemn stuff. Mm-hmm. I go back to the Vietnam War protests, you know, and we had a lot of fun. I mean, sex, drugs, and rock and roll were all over the place, and we won. We won. You know, sometimes I think this environmental movement these days is just a little too serious. We ought to probably have more fun doing it, mm-hmm. and to realize truly that there's nothing, nothing more satisfying or rewarding than creating a better world. I mean, that's what you guys do with your radio program. I doubt if you're becoming millionaires off this radio program.
Oh, no, we pay to be on the air.
Yeah, exactly.
We have to ask for donations.
Because you enjoy it. And
I have people like yourself on.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, that's... I used to make an awful lot more money when I was in business and an economic hitman than I do writing books, I'll tell you. But this is a lot more fun and a lot more rewarding.
Yeah.
And I think if people really get that, the guys on Wall Street are not having fun.
No, and you have that youthful spirit. Now, although you had some fun, it sounds like a different kind when you were young.
Well, I've always had fun in one way or another, I think. But, you know... When I was an economic hitman, I was traveling first class around the world. I was staying in the best hotels. I was eating in the finest restaurants. I was wined and dined by presidents and gorgeous women. And I was popping Valium constantly. I was practically an alcoholic. I wasn't quite an alcoholic, but I came damn close to it. I went through a terrible divorce. I was extremely unhappy.
Yeah.
Even though it seemed as though I was doing all the things that are supposed to make us happy, the things I just mentioned. I wasn't happy.
Yeah.
I'm not doing any. I don't fly first class anymore. I don't stay in the best hotels unless somebody like your radio program puts me up with them. Like, the people in Walnut Creek are putting me up in a hotel for one night, but I bet it won't be the best hotel in Walnut Creek. I can guarantee it, and I don't want it to be.
But yeah, I'd rather camp.
So much more fun, you know?
Yeah.
It's so much more rewarding.
You know, maybe you can come to Santa Cruz after you visit Walnut Creek. I can talk to some of our bookstores, our independent bookstores. Would it be possible for you to come over here?
I think it's a little late to do that for this in the short notice. But you could get in touch with my publicist who set up this program.
I will
arrange something for go out there, so just let Peg know that
I will.
You could make that happen.
And we're going to have to end pretty soon, but I want to remind our listeners that you're going to be speaking at the Mount Diablo Unitarian Universalist Church Monday night, February 22nd at 7 p.m. And at 5:30, there's a reception. And are you going to be at the reception?
I'm sure I will be, but I don't know who else is. I don't know whether that's open to the public. It doesn't say on here, but it says I'm expected to be there, so I will be there, yes.
And it's with the Mount Diablo Peace? Who is sponsoring this?
Mount Diablo Peace and Justice Center.
Peace and Justice Center. And their phone number is 925-933-7850. Great. I'm sure it'll be packed. I hope tickets are still available. I would hope it's a large center.
And incidentally, also next summer in June, there's a big conference up in Vancouver about 2012.
Really?
By the Prophets Conference.
Oh.
And I'm speaking at that, too, along with the person who co-led the trip with me, Lynn Roberts, who I mentioned, and a number of other very noted experts on the subject. Yeah, Lynn Roberts,
and, yeah.
And you can find about that conference at johnperkins.org or go to the Prophets Conference website. It's a major event.
They were just in Mexico. Yeah, and now we have the Olympics. A friend of mine attended who's living down there now for a while.
Many of the same people that were speaking in Cancun at their conference there, like Jose Arguelles, is also going to be up at Vancouver. Mm. So it'll be a great conference.
Certainly will.
I want to thank both you, John, for speaking about the owl, and you, Cindy, for speaking about the ravens. Just to move us into that thinking of that it's not just about the humans that we're doing this to make better life. It's for all the...
And our ancestors as well.
It's for all.
Yeah.
Thank you. John, this has been just a wonderful conversation.
For me, too. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. This has been such an honor. I've really been listening to you and reading your book since Dream Change. When I heard you on Democracy Now! Years ago, I thought, that's the man that wrote Dream Change. What was his history? Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Yes,
you're welcome.
Right.
And thanks for doing what you're doing. And keep up your great work.
I have a lot of fun.
All right.
Thanks. Yeah. Good talking to you both.
I like you. Likewise. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Dream Change.
Oh, wonderful. That was John Perkins. How exciting. And next we're going to be talking with Jeffrey Grupp about telementation and how to create more of who we really are and where we're headed.
Please enter the number you wish to dial.
Stretch on here forever. Footprints behind us together. Many eyes have beheld this hollow ground. In Lakesh. Ooh.
Some wonderful medicine music. That was Lakesh. And we have now with us online Jeffrey Grupp, and he is the author of numerous books. One is Corporatism and the Invisible Government, Everything is Controlled, Especially the Revolution, The Telescreen, An Empirical Study of the Destruction of Consciousness, Light, Ecstasy and Ufology, The Art Theory of Time. He is quite diverse, and his most recent book is Telementation, Cosmic Feeling and the Law of Attraction. And he was actually born in Michigan, 1970. He resides in West Lafayette, Indiana. He's a former professor, and he taught teaching philosophy, specifically Eastern philosophy, ethics, metaphysics, and Buddhism. I believe he is a Buddhist. And his political party, Constitution Party, and he says his music preference is Baroque. I want to welcome you on, Jeffrey. Are you here? Are you with us?
I am. Thank you very much for having me on the show.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for coming on. I think I heard you late one night, and I was fascinated by the diversity with which you went from one topic to another. But today, it's telementation, pretty much, and that's the cosmic feeling and the law of attraction. And I love what you wrote in the very beginning when you dedicated the book to Amy, Amelia, and Chloe. You said, and for the citizens of the world everywhere who, whether they know it or not, are trying to awaken from the dark night of the soul and from the nightmare of history. And you explain how to do that beautifully in telementation. And just for starters, can you explain to us what telementation is in your own words for the listeners?
Okay, telementation is consciousness. Typically, the average person spends their entire life looking outward, out at the world, and rarely will they go in a quiet place, close their eyes, and look at what's going on on the inside world, your feelings, your thoughts, and so forth. And when you do that, especially regularly and with some, you know, significant attention, so you're not, you know, your mind isn't wandering and daydreaming when you're doing that, you're really trying to find out what's going on the inside, you find out that your consciousness is composed of very profound feeling states that you would not have noticed unless you were looking inside yourself, feeling your feelings or watching your feelings.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll also notice that, just amazingly, if you do, see, I learned this because I, as you said, I'm a Buddhist. I have been for 19 years. And
what school of Buddhism?
Soto Zen.
Uh-huh, Japanese.
Mm-hmm, yeah, which is a later development. And my favorite author is actually a European. Well, he's dead now, but his name is Hubert Benoit, or Benoit, if you want to pronounce it in the French. But what you notice when you're doing this observation of these profound feeling states within you, that your feelings correspond to reality. So in other words, if you feel a certain way about reality, if you fear you're going to get in a car crash and you have profoundly intensive feelings over that, whether you know it, you might not know you do unless you look inside yourself and you notice that those feelings are there, you'll notice that you will get in a car crash sometime, somewhat proximate in time to when you had those feelings. Or if you feel that you're like the example in the, I use in the book, telementation, is if you feel, well, it's because this is a telementational exercise I've done. If you feel that your wife, if a man feels his wife, for example, is going to have a particularly wonderful day,
mm-hmm.
And he feels it as deeply as possible, and he believes it so much that he's convinced it's just the truth, absolute truth, then he will find out that she had an absolutely wonderful day. And there's never an exception. If he has the right feeling state and the right belief state combination, it always happens. It's as if it's axiomatic, or it's as if it's a law of nature, that your deep feeling states are corresponding to reality. So what this makes us, what makes you believe is that these feeling states, since they come earlier in time than mm-hmm. the manifestation of reality, you have to start to surmise that these feeling states are causing these to come into existence. And believe it or not, we have possible scientific evidence for this being the case. And this is a basic belief in primitive cultures for thousands of years.
And you talk about, in your book, the accumulation of mental energy, and that's the difference between just a fleeting thought that we may have mm-hmm. and the depth of the accumulated mental energy. And you write about the importance of focusing, feeling, and what's the knowingness, a knowing, when you mm-hmm. access that place.
Yes, this is telementation. These processes, these dynamics of deep feeling states to manifestations in reality, this is what goes on our entire life. It's just people don't notice this because, as I said, they're always looking outside. They're looking at their TV. They're looking at their checkbook. They're, you know, chit-chatting with friends about last night's TV show at work. We're wasting this power that we have in us, and it's written about in all of our world religions,
mm-hmm.
As I said. And if you have a fleeting thought within you, that's not likely to manifest. But it's your overall profound feeling states, rather than thought states, feeling states. Now, there's a popular book out there called The Secret, which is all about this topic, but it's a little bit different than the way I describe, which I can discuss.
Oh, please,
a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Tell us the difference.
Okay. Yeah, it's very important because when I was still teaching philosophy in the Purdue University system, I was writing this book and I was experimenting with this. I knew this existed back in the 1990s when I was first becoming, you know, learning how to do meditation in my mm-hmm. daily Buddhist practice. I still meditate every day. And I noticed these correlations, and then I didn't really care that much back then, if you want the truth. I just thought it was interesting, and I knew that some people thought quantum physics sort of predicted that this happened and so forth. So, but in the 2000s, when I, you know, had children and needed money and so forth, I started to take more interest in this, and I wanted to learn how to channel this rather than. So everybody has this going on inside them. The point of the book Telementation is to show you how to steer this. So if you can manifest reality in a way that you want it to, okay, you don't want to have deep fear states in you and therefore have reality manifest fearful scenarios, because this will happen.
The one concern, though, is it is very powerful.
This is the ultimate
agree.
Power in the universe.
It is, and it can. Can you say a little bit about using it negatively and why mm-hmm. that most likely isn't going to be a possibility?
Okay, that I don't know if that's ever happened in reality. One thing first, if you can actually do this, if you can will and feel reality into existence in a certain way you desire, that is the most incredible power in nature, and that is exactly what our consciousness is. It, as the Buddhists said for thousands of years, consciousness creates reality. And Jesus said in the Bible, your faith can move that mountain. I mean, this is well known among world religions, and some in quantum physics theorize it, as I said, but it's almost completely forgotten in our modern day, you know, TV watching America.
Often it's discounted. You're considered crazy if you go around saying that, which I think is also a shield for not knowing who what we are really capable of.
Mm-hmm. Yes, we're supposed to believe that the outside world is sort of operates on its own randomly. And we can't control it with our consciousness, but it can control us. The world can. The social sciences, for example,
that's the illusion.
That environment creates the behavior, That's the basis of economics and sociology and so forth.
And
that's really just a form of fatalism, where you don't have much control. Your consciousness is controlled by reality, so there's not much you can do. If you stub your toe, well, it was destined to happen.
You know, we were just speaking to someone about the dream. He had spent some time in Ecuador with the indigenous in the Amazon, and they said, your dream needs to be changed.
Yeah, they all know about this. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Aboriginal Dreamtime. I often discuss the rain dance of Native America. Mm-hmm. They're just, if you get the group together and they have a ceremony for rain, they all believe and feel deeply that rain is coming, and it happens. It's like clockwork. And I mean, as I was saying earlier, our consciousness is this process. It's just we've often thought of our consciousness in Freudian terms or various psychological terms, but if we actually look at it and find out what's happening in our consciousness, it is this telementational power. And like you said, it could be used. I mean, it has to be done responsibly. The reason, however, that I don't fear that if somebody actually learned, for example, I know how to do this power. Anybody can buy my book and learn how to do it. You just have to learn the art. You could learn it in a week or so. The book, The Secret, I don't think gives you step-by-step how to, you know, here's what you do step one, here's what you do step two. You know, you have to master each of these steps. There's only really three steps in my book. No, and you just have to have specific instructions on knowing what to do. And I used to talk to my students at Purdue University who were trying to master this, and they would say, yeah, I read the book The Secret, and I couldn't really figure it out. And I knew that was because they were focusing on channeling their thoughts in certain ways, or their visualizations, you know, this mental imagery we have inside of us in certain ways. And I said, that won't work, because what's connected to the source of creation, the fountainhead of the universe, is your feelings. If you do meditation and locate in you, well, I call it the feeling master, the inner star seed, in my book, you'll find when you are at that level, you will feel it connected to everything. And you'll feel that you have the ability to to will things into existence as you want them to be. Now, in that state, to answer that question you asked, a good question, this is a state of spiritual ecstasy. Okay, now you don't have to be, you know, St. Paul on the road to Damascus, blinded by the light of God and falling, you know, I mean, metaphorically blinded by the light of God, falling down on the ground in spiritual ecstasy. Now, that helps if you're at that state of spiritual joy and accomplishing telementation, but you don't have to be at that level. There's many different levels of meditation. If you just get a tiny bit into it, just a little bit, you can have absolutely profound success at doing telementation, my word for the law of attraction. And you also will have incredible increases in your intelligence, and you'll have incredible happiness compared to your old life. I mean, the life of the personality, as it could be called, the everyday person pushed around by the forces of life, and then just finally getting to their television at night for a moment of addictive escape, that person is not happy. Okay, they may feel happy when they watch their TV, but if they looked inside themselves, they would feel empty. They would not feel any sort of spiritual effervescence. And we have to get to the state. This is the key to telementation. You have to develop the real side of you, which is spiritual joy. Now, you don't, like I said, you don't have to go all the way and be Buddha meditating under the Bodhi tree in Nirvana, because you can have just slight success. I mean, if you do, that's great, but if you just have small amounts of success in mystical happiness, telementation just follows naturally, and it's absolutely, I mean, everybody needs to get to this state in their lives, because this is what we're destined to be. This is what humans are
we're
made
wired
for.
Wired to be.
That's,
that's where our joy comes from.
That's what I hear you saying that's what we are, and that's my understanding. What you're talking about reminds me of an Indian master, Sri Nisargadatta, who says, you're not in the world is in you. And,
yep.
Yeah, and so I got to say, I'm really heartened to hear you speaking of this, because you're from the heartland, brother.
Well,
and that's a good thing. So
But I'd like to get a, I got two things on my mind. One is I'd like you to break down your definition of telementation back to the etymology. You put these words, these syllables together because of the Greek or Latin, I would say, roots. And then the second thing is that turning inward and looking at oneself and knowing oneself, that's such an important part because if other people are at all like me, there's a lot of negative programming in there that really has, for myself, shielded me from access to my true self or access to this state of bliss that I hear you speaking about. So I just...
Continue.
Yeah.
Addressing
that aspect of clearing away the clutter, the clutter of negativity.
Well, you're absolutely right. When you look inside yourself, and I always speak really through the lens of Buddhism, since that's the where I come from. But that does need not be the case now. But what I discovered when I started to explore my consciousness way back when I first became a Buddhist, I couldn't believe all of the assumptions that I'd carried on through my life. I mean, people told me about the philosophy of cause and effect. And then I went to graduate school and took a class called causation, professors and students, read and researched on how to describe causation. And every single definition of causation ended in a contradiction. And I thought, that is exactly my hunch of what's going on.
Can you talk a little bit about that, the contradictions that you...
Mm-hmm. Well, every single aspect of external reality, if you go to an academic philosophy department and ask them, explain to me causation, explain time, explain, magnitude, or how does a physical object have size? Can you describe what size is? Define it for me. Define space. Every single one of these things ends in a contradiction, and the academic philosophers know this, and they view philosophy as trying to figure out the coherent descriptions. But, for example, if you take take motion, there's another one that, if you try to describe it, ends in a contradiction. If you, for example, shot a gun with a glowing bullet in a dark room, you would see a line. Okay, now that line, strictly speaking, doesn't exist. Okay, that's because your eyes can't see the bullet moving from moment to moment. Now, if you could take a picture of the bullets at every instant with an ultra-fast camera that could just take a picture of a still bullet, you would get just that. You would get a picture of a still bullet. Now, isn't that bullet supposed to be moving? Now, how can you have a picture of a still bullet when the bullet's moving? So to make a long story short, motion consists of stillness. Now, that's a contradiction. And the ancient Greek philosopher Zeno knew this, and for 2,500 years since, philosophers have been trying to explain it in consistent terms, and they can't.
No.
The whole outside world is not what's actually real. What's actually real is something like what the quantum physicists are describing for us, which is a ultra-energetic field of energy. And I would myself add in the further description, spiritual energy. So what our senses pick up is not actually what's real. It's partially real or just what our senses perceive or something. I'm not saying that when you look at your child today, they don't exist. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying what your senses perceive is not real. If you could see your child correctly, you would see she or he is a being composed of energy and light, or spiritual energy, I would say. And it's all interacting with consciousness.
We're somewhat limited in this dimension in terms of what we can actually see. We can only see what our eyes allow us to see, but there's another way of seeing.
Yeah, there's a...
We
you see
don't have
your
the
eyes,
capacity as a rule.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, your eyes see what are called surfaces and colors, just shapes that move around. Now, really what's doing the seeing, though, is not your eyes. Is there's an experiencing center in your brain and consciousness, which is creating little pictures in your brain and consciousness. That's really where the seeing goes on. The eyes are just down the line a little bit. Now, you can call that the mind's eye.
Yes.
Now, actually, that mind's eye can see everything that exists. It's unlimited, and how much of reality it can take in. Your eyes can only see, you know, these moving surfaces, which is, well, we, as we just got done explaining, can be shown to not even fully be real. But your mind's eye, however, like you were telling me before the show in an email, you wanted to discuss the Tibetan Book of the Dead. That's a good example. The mind's eye in shamanism, the mind, you know, the in an out-of-body experience, the person can journey. And I mean, anybody who's done a little bit of productive meditation knows these experiences. You'll be there meditating in your back porch, and you get to a productive vibe or mode, and all of a sudden you'll just have images pop in your mind, say of a galaxy or something, and you'll want some of these images, you'll say, wait a minute, those were so real that I don't feel like I was just imagining that. I was there.
And then if someone else has something very similar and someone else, there's validation.
Right. All you need for validation is mass agreement. So if we were, if our science was operated or oriented towards not just external position or, you know, outward looking consciousness, but also inward, we would all have shared experiences. Mm-hmm. I did an experience my last semester teaching, or second to last semester teaching, had a very good summer class that taught in Buddhist philosophy at Purdue University. And it was a very small class, and we did a group meditation the last day, and we all reported our experiences. And I had things happen. For example, I felt like I was floating. I mean, I've been doing meditation for 19 years, and I never had that experience before. But I noticed before I reported that I had felt that, a number of students out there said, yeah, I felt like I was floating. And I just said, okay, this is akin to scientific verification. Okay, because we're both in our experience having the, you know, the same experience, and so we can report on it. So it's, I mean, the limits, there's really no limits
there here
on how we can reshape the world with something like telementation and spirituality.
So what can our listeners do to practically apply this information? Or how can the average person that's overlooked it, for lack of a better word, average person, how can,
well,
how can it be explored further?
Well, I'd love to say, well, just go pick up any book on this subject, but I think, to be honest, they have to pick up my book.
Exactly.
The reason I wrote the book is because I couldn't figure out how to get to channel this. To channel your telementational power, your power of consciousness productively, because I would read books. There's been other books that were written about this way before The Secret, such as Atkinson's book, Mind Power, which was written in the 1920s. I had to figure out myself how to do it, okay? And all the other books couldn't teach me that. So, I mean, I guess I'm a little biased. I think my book is the only book that successfully shows someone. You have to find certain states of consciousness inside you. It's very easy to do with a little bit of practice. Mm-hmm. And it's absolutely blissful. Because your inner consciousness is bliss.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's what everybody says. All the teachers.
Yes. Yeah. And you talk about the importance of first focusing, knowing, and then emphasize the feeling aspect. Can mm-hmm. you go into those three a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a state of feeling within us that is the absolute bedrock of our consciousness. It's typically a person will not know it exists unless you take a little bit of time to find out what you are made of, to find out what your consciousness is all about, because that's what you are. You're not hands and feet and so forth. You're your consciousness. Now, when they locate this most powerful aspect of our feeling states, which are right there. I mean, any of us could just look right now and feel it. To be honest, I just did. I mean, I'm just used to doing this all the time throughout the day. And when you do that, what you can do is you can couple that feeling with a thought. Okay, notice how the feeling has to be there in a certain state of power
mm-hmm.
with the thought coupled to it. That's what The Secret, for example, leaves out. Well, that's what most of these, even Atkinson's book, Mind Power, back in the 1920s, hardly touches on it.
On the feeling.
You have to have this certain, it's a very specific deep state of feeling, which is easy to find. But if you couple that with a certain belief, say, my wife will have a particularly good day today, and the belief has to be not, most beliefs are forms of hope. You know, I believe that, you know, the stock market will go up, but really you're just hoping, and then it, you know, dumps the next day or something. So what you have to do is you have to know. The belief has to be such that I just, it's in a fact, it's a law of reality. It's a fact that my wife will have a terrific day today. And if it's coupled with that deep state of feeling, there is absolutely no question that it will happen. It's like, well, I was trying to think of a scientific analogy, but it's as if it's as sure as if you drop a ball, it will fall.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like a law of gravity type of scenario.
So there's a deep knowingness and belief.
Mm-hmm.
It's there's nothing to counteract that, contradict it.
I think there's three laws of telementation in the book. I think that's the second.
It is.
If you carry out the reaction properly within you, it's an impossibility that it will not come, that you will not manifest.
Because that's one of the laws of the universe.
Mm-hmm. Well, the universe is created by its spiritual energy. Spiritual ecstasy is what the universe is actually made of. Now that may sound strange to the average person who watches television every day and eats their hot dogs and everything, but if you're actually doing what humans are supposed to do, which is exercising spiritual experience through meditation and so forth, this is the most natural and understandable and obvious thing in the world. And all these people who are talking about materialism and you see that they're just completely mistaken. Okay, that's just I don't know if I want to say it's an illusion, but it really kind of is an illusion.
And that's part of your book, Corporatism. I think one of the reasons mm-hmm. that we're in the mess that we're in is because we've had a mass illusion about reality, and it's not true, so it's collapsing before our eyes. It was finite. It wasn't mm-hmm. limited. It wasn't drawing upon the spiritual truth and the spiritual energy, sustenance. Mm-hmm.
And the focus on the material does have a corollary to it of that emptiness that you spoke of, as when you go through your day and all you can do is just wait to get home and space out, either in front of the TV or with a beer
right.
or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
Music.
Yeah, we live in the Prozac nation.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Oh, isn't that the truth? And Go ahead. I was just going to talk about the frequency of that feeling, how important it is.
Which feeling? The spacing out feeling or the connected feeling?
Oh, any feeling. What's so important in this practice is the frequency, how often, you've written about that in the book, how often you bring back that feeling, you recreate it to strengthen the impact of
okay,
meditation.
Okay, absolutely. That's what I call the inner star seed. And actually I have a movie that I'm making. It's just a small documentary. It's just being finished up now. It's the only place I think I'm going to sell is at my website, which is antimatterradio.com.
Mm-hmm. Antimatterradio.com mm-hmm. is your website. That's anti matter.
Actually, I should tell the listeners I have another website called, probably I'm so used to talking about that website. I should tell them about my other website. It's telementation.com, which has
great.
All sorts of information about telementation.
No, I've checked out both your websites briefly, but so I have a corollary question to you. So just say, for instance, the possibility that everybody does go out and buy your book. What are you going to do with all that money? What good stuff
well,
are you going to do?
That's a good question. Now, you might wonder why. Let me answer that in two ways. You might wonder why I even would care about the money coming in from it, because if I can do telementation, I can just will myself to have as much money as I want. See, the point is, though, of telementation is when that doesn't really make sense in telementational terms, because when a person practices, what gets to a level of telementational success, they're existing in some degree or other of spiritual happiness, and you're not very greedy in those kinds of states. You don't really care about you know, three TVs in your house or something like that. I mean, now I've done telementation for money and I've accumulated significant amounts in the past, but it was enough needed for my family. I would will a certain amount and I would get exactly that amount a month or three later. That was when I was first learning how to channel it years ago, and I just thought that was so amazing that in the unusual ways the money would come to me. But to answer your question, any amount of money I have that goes over and above what I need to support my family, I just simply give away. I've said that on radio before. That's never happened, actually.
Mm-hmm.
But if it does, my radio show is getting sort of big. And if that does happen, though, I don't have any need for it. I don't know what to do with it. So it'll either sit in the bank unused, or I can give it to help the world.
Well, one of the reasons I asked that question is that I'm very curious about. Well, I'd like to encourage people to get the book, and for myself to know that good things are going to be done with the excess, or that there's more than one pathway for the flow, not just to you as an individual, but through you and outward to help make life better for other people and other beings.
Yeah, anybody who knows me personally knows it's a no-brainer that I'm completely unconcerned with the average say financial strivings that people have. I just want to know things. All I care about is knowledge and spiritual experience. That's where I find my happiness. If other people have other things, that's great. But that's what I'm obsessed with.
And I told a few friends you were coming on, and they asked what your spiritual or religious background was. And I said, I thought it was Buddhism, but it's quite universal. And what I love about your book is it really does offer that positive, practical application of meditation. Mm-hmm. And it's a surprise because you can go, I haven't yet hit that, but I'm practicing daily, that place where I can access that feeling state of nirvana, of joy.
Mm-hmm.
To me, I don't have any control over it. I've experienced it in bits and pieces.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm looking forward to that because your book outlines everything so concretely in their actual definitions, so you understand exactly what you're referring to. Consciousness,
yeah.
Religion, you give specific definitions so everyone can follow the map clearly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you've hit on one thing that's absolutely critical. If you find this space, this place within you, this location, this feeling intensity that's in you, you'll notice that it's just been right there at the surface your whole life, and you've just not been looking at it. But once you do locate it, you can even call it an inner tension. It's just the deepest part of your feelings that you have.
What was so interesting?
Pardon?
It was interesting. I was just practicing it a week ago after I received the book, and I closed my eyes, and I actually felt like a rocket just propelling upward with the fire in my feet.
Right.
Went, whoa! It scared me.
Yes. It's definitely... we're taught that what's exciting is football, and it does, you know, if people like football, fine. But we're taught that that's what's exhilarating, and those things are absolute... brain deadness compared to spiritual ecstasy, which, again, as I've said, is all the universe is actually made of, is spiritual ecstasy. But if you can learn to locate this within you, you can be walking up the stairs, for example, as I just happened to me a few minutes ago, and you can just access this fountainhead, this inner starseed, as I call it, this feeling intensity in you, and just channel it with a thought, a belief, and a knowing, more appropriately said, to make something happen. And I want to be careful. I don't want people to think I'm some sort of bizarre person, but I've gotten proficient enough at it where I can make things happen just within a few seconds often. I mean, and that may sound weird to people because we're supposed to believe, we're taught, on television indirectly in, you know, churches and TV and so forth, that, you know, we're not that special. We don't have these powers. We're just supposed to be just pushed around by the forces of life, and there's not much we can do about it. But it's, you know, somebody proved that to me, because no people have told me these things, and they've hinted this philosophy of humans having, you know, we've got this huge brain, but there's nothing special about it. But nobody's ever given me evidence, and when I actually look at the real nature of humanity, I see there is something unfathomably powerful and special about us, and it's centered around our consciousness, and we do have these abilities. Our quantum physics has found over the last 80 years that reality is composed of waves of energy. But if you go and actually try to find out, investigate what they are, what you find is the wave collapses down to a particle, which we'll call electron or quark or whatever. Now, when people try to do a measurement of these waves of energy, what happens is this collapsing down happens. So people have theorized what is making that happen, because when somebody goes and does the measurement, the collapse happens down to a particle. A wave collapses down to a particle, hence the wave-particle duality. Now, one of the things involved in measurement is intent or observation, or more specifically, consciousness. So a lot of people have theorized in some degree or something, what is making reality collapse down into the particles that compose everything is our consciousness. Now, the implication here is that in some way or another, consciousness is behind composing reality, but this is, of course, what our spiritual traditions have known for thousands of years,
right,
have been telling us.
Right.
And you, in your book, too, you distinguish the difference between the ego, the feeling mass, and the nirvana states. And the ego is motion. It's rapidly random thoughts going through. Can you discuss that a little bit, too? Because that's so important, that that distinction. It's
that
key to this form
important.
Of meditation.
Okay, I wanted to, often when people start telementation, they instantly say, ah, I notice a lot of my radio listeners are doing this, which is fine. I mean, I did the same thing when I was getting started in all this. They will say, you know, they'll want to head right for nirvana. So what I did is I divided consciousness not into two areas, which the Zen Buddhists often do, you know, egotistical pain and suffering, which is the ordinary person that we see in the world, versus absolute spiritual ecstasy. Well, it's actually beyond words what nirvana is, but usually they're divided into two by Buddhists. But what I wanted to do is divide it into three, and that's in order to make people not feel they have such a lofty goal to achieve to accomplish telemeditation. All you need to do is just disintegrate the ordinary state of consciousness that you live through every day, which is a state of pain and suffering. If you just disintegrate it a tiny bit, you will experience mystical states of consciousness. They can be very short-lived or long-lived, but you will, a whole world of happiness and freedom will be open to you that you'll say, I can't believe this is here all along, and I never knew it. This is what I'm made of, and I've been ignoring it because I've been looking at my TV set my whole life.
And is that basically eliminating thought or observing it carefully?
No, that I get that question all the time. That's more of a Hindu, well, I got to be careful what I say here. It is in Buddhism as well. Even the Buddha would discuss, you know, eliminating thought is, I think that the idea of eliminating thought is irrelevant. All one needs to do is practice the meditations as I describe them in telemeditation, which are basically Soto Zen meditation practices, but it just in real simple language in the way I describe it. I tried to make this book absolutely as simple as possible so everybody can accomplish it. What happens is, in those states, is you don't eliminate thought. What happens is your state of feeling becomes so, if you go all the way to a nirvanic domain, or nirvanic state of intensity, let's say, you know, intensity is being used in a positive sense there. What happens is your feeling states become so powerful that you transcend beyond them into a state of spiritual ecstasy, which really, to say it's spiritual ecstasy is misleading because it's ineffable. It's beyond words. So you still have thought in there. I mean, if you're at work and you've, for example, I had a job when I was in college at the University of New Mexico back in the 1990s. I purposely got a job which would allow me to do meditation the most proficiently. It was loading boxes on a truck. there was this the most ideal job for practicing meditation. And I experienced some of my most powerful meditative experiences there. And it wasn't, and I knew what I was in was something, it was where the Buddhist aims to be. And it wasn't as if thought and language vanished and I had no process of thought. What it was is just that thought was so absolutely insignificant to my overall mental process and even my perception that it's you might as well just discount it as being nothing. So I think eliminating thought also, what people need to do, let me just get right to the point here. What people need to do is focus on your feelings. That's what meditation is. Feel your feelings. It's that simple. That's all meditation is. And if you do that, for some strange reason, the most powerful mystical experiences happen. If you look outward your whole life, you have pain and suffering. But if you focus inward to some significant degree, the opposite happens. Pain and suffering goes away. Happiness explodes within you. Your intelligence raises. It's as if there's two opposite reactions. Look outward your whole life and certain things happen. Look inward and the opposite things happen. So it's just very, very, very easy to do.
And I think sometimes feeling the feeling, if it's anger or fear intensely, is so initially overwhelmingly painful that the tendency is to want to shut it down and stop it at all costs. So the first level.
If you are hammering a nail and you accidentally hit your thumb, if you look at your thumb in that throbbing pain and dive into the feeling and feel it as intensely as you can, what happens? It immediately vanishes.
That's true.
Okay? So if you go into things and look, if you penetrate right into the core feeling states of your consciousness, actually that ties into what you were just asking. They will blast away, and something, you go into something beyond, something greater, something that transcends. And that's, everybody can do this right now. I'm not saying go inflict pain on yourself, but if you were really desperate to taste what I'm talking about, that would work. And I mean, when you go to these places that are beyond, that's the whole point, and it's so easy to do. And you'll notice it was there all along. This is what I'm made of.
Whatever that feeling is at that moment. For those of you that are just tuning in now, we're speaking with Jeffrey Grupp, and he's the author of Telementation, and we're learning basically how to create reality from deep within ourselves, and it's learning about our natural state of being. This is Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.1 FM.
Okay, Jeffrey, I'd like to ask you again, so how do you break down telementation?
That's actually not my term. That's Atkinson's. Atkinson is in his book, Mind Power, I forgot the exact date, in the 1920s, he came up with the term. I think I have that footnote in my books giving him the credit for that term.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see tele, you know, by distance, mentation, mental process. So mental process at a distance. I just thought that was, to be honest, I just thought it was a powerful term. Words are so powerful, I just, the word telementation just really struck it just struck a chord in me when I heard
curiosity.
It, because that's what we're talking about.
And so the feeling mass is that beautiful, blissful feeling state. And then nirvana, I don't believe I've experienced that, but what's the difference?
Okay, if those of you out there who practice telementation, and if you take a week and you really work at it and you find the feeling mass within you and learn to go back to it whenever you want to, when you can get to that state, telementation is an absolute breeze for you. It's like chewing gum. It's so easy. And you can really create a wonderful life for yourself. But if you were to take it a step further and really focus in the, just go right, penetrate deep into the heart of that feeling mass as much as you can, mm-hmm. you'll find that the center is a deeper, more ecstatic state yet, and that's nirvana. And that's why the diagram of consciousness I give in the book, I forgot what page it's on, it's three concentric circles. The outside is ego.
Yeah, page 68.
The middle one is feeling mass, and then the center is nirvana. And so you go deeper and deeper into the center, and the more ecstasy follows. But again, I don't want to discourage people. You don't need to go, you can, if you have the drive to do that much meditation, wonderful. But to succeed radically well at telementation, you just need to enter what's called, I call the feeling mass state, which is basically just a state centered on awareness and living through this feeling intensity that is in you. And it's so absolutely, it's just, the best definition of it is freedom.
Yeah.
We all, this is the definition of us.
And most religions have said that, maybe a little esoterically, mm-hmm. it seems to be hidden and not brought out in the established religions, but the initial teachers of each religion were practicing that and sharing it. It got watered down.
Well, that seems to be because if you have a bunch of a population that's satisfied with feeling and being alive, what are they going to buy? How are you going to get them to do anything?
Right, yeah. Well, you don't need money to do telementation. You don't need status.
Mm-hmm.
You don't need, all you need is the desire to break out. And I'm being serious too. I mean, mm-hmm. you really do need this desire. If you don't have the desire to change anything about your life, then you don't need to practice telementation. But if you want more, if you want something to go better in your life, or more specifically, if you want more fulfillment, if you feel empty and lost in this mega culture and civilization that we live in, telementation can give that to you. And when you experience these spiritual states, you'll know exactly what I mean when I say something like money is so absolutely pointless and uninteresting compared to this humming spiritual ecstasy that's everywhere. So to say that somebody would do harm to someone when they learn telementation doesn't make sense, because how would, when you have this much happiness and freedom, you just want absolutely everybody in the world to feel it. You know that they actually do, but mm-hmm. you want them to realize it, or as the Buddhist yeah. would say, you want them to remember it. You want to help them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And
so that's the whole point.
And I think that's why you wrote the book, because you also, this is what I found so interesting about you, you are in the process of writing The Invisible Government, I think. I'm not sure if it's published or yet. Everything is controlled, especially the revolution, because you could see the madness and the suffering that people are experiencing. Could you say a little bit about that book and maybe corporatism? How have you bridged the two? I know we emailed back and forth about that.
Mm-hmm.
And...
well, okay, corporatism is the one that's really selling well on Amazon. That book that's my first book I ever wrote. It's totally different than Telementation is a book you read and you just feel so powerful,
yes.
and poetic and wonderful when you read it. Just reading the sentences,
well,
I just feel transformed. But corporatism it's more of an academic book. I wrote that in my last, when I was winding down and stopping teaching to do other things like radio and just writing full time. And that's an all-out research book, which really attempts to find out what the structure of the world is, the social world, and what it is what's called corporatism. That term comes from Mussolini. And corporatism is the merger of big military, big government, and big business, when those three become indistinguishable. And that's the world we live in. That's the world we've lived in for the last couple thousand years. I mean, people have called it socialism and democracy and libertarianism and communism, but it's always been the merger of those three things, wherever you look, whether it's back to the medieval kings or whatever. So, what you have then is a world of absolute horror. There's starvation, pain, war. We have a president who we thought we were going to remove troops, but he's adding them again. It's just like Bush.
It's
money is thrown at the rich. People in Angola don't even have beds. They have to sleep in dirt. We have people in America losing their jobs, and who's even paying attention to that? The troops haven't come home from Iraq. It's just sort of to form an occupation like the troops that are still in South Korea. And it's really a bad situation. And the answer is
telementation.
Mm-hmm.
I can absolutely see that.
Mm-hmm.
And what I do on this show is to let people know the truth of what's happening as I understand it, as I've seen it, and then give them options and opportunities to do it differently and to make a difference and jump in where they feel drawn.
Mm-hmm.
And you've done this with corporatism and then telementation. Because I haven't read corporatism yet, but it sounds like you lay out exactly what we're experiencing and the causes and what we can do to shift it.
Yeah, I say in corporatism that I say that the source of all of our problems in life is this corporate structure. Now, in the book, I describe how that's synonymous with saying we are de-spiritualized. And mm-hmm. our corporatist structure turns us into machines
mm-hmm.
and factory cogs. And that is the synonymous with saying that we do not focus on religious practice, on more appropriately put, spiritual meditation, as we've described here. The two are one.
Yeah, corporatism, my understanding of what you're saying, I too have not read that book yet, and it's on the to-read list. But just, focus.
Yeah, I've got a copy coming to you.
All right.
Oh, good.
Focus on this life only, this life being 0 to 70 or 80 or 90, and what can I accumulate this life only? It's not, and what mm-hmm. you're talking about in telementation is blowing out those boundaries mm-hmm. and still being here. So, and what I'm interested in, how in your telementation are you working to reshape the world that we're living in? Are you doing some specific work?
Absolutely. Actually, a former student of mine tried some experiments. We wanted to see if we could influence the actions of world leaders with telementation.
Mm-hmm.
This was back when Bush was still president. And we did get some strange synchronicities, I guess is a good word to use. We wanted George Bush to talk about a number of things to expose them about what the corruption in government is doing. And we did get some, he basically did expose some of these things, but it was on Japanese TV. And we just couldn't believe that happened about 2 weeks after we did the experiment. And so, because we wanted to find out, is this just a local thing, or can one consciousness change the world? And we sort of thought that one consciousness could change the world. So what I've done in my telementational practice is I've tried to get the world to wake up to their inherent spiritual ecstasy within. And I mean, maybe it's, I don't know if it's me, but the world is, since the 60s, has been waking up to this.
It's absolutely
it has.
Waking up.
Yet the government is still obsessed with corporate profit, and that's at any cost. And I think that they have, well, I know they have control over the government, and you apparently wrote about that, too, in corporatism.
Well, that's what a think tank and a lobbyist are. I mean,
yes.
I mean, if you know what a think tank and a lobbyist is, then that's absolute proof that votes don't matter.
Yeah,
I mean, we can vote whoever we want, but then what happens doesn't. Pardon?
Vote with the dollars.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So we need different people in government. What office do you want to run for?
No, I don't think we need different people in government. We need to get back to, we need to strip away the think tanks and for example, if you eliminated the power of a lobbyist, I can't remember, that was made legal in the 1880s or something. That's basically when someone can go to a congressperson and say, here's some money to vote this way, to pass this policy, this legislation. And that should be illegal, because that completely undercuts the power of voting. I mean, this is no secret. Lobbyists, we talk about this on the news.
Yes.
If they were eliminated, then votes all of a sudden do matter.
So you're saying, and I agree, it sounds like you're saying that the corporations control the social and psychological structure of our reality.
Yeah, that's the whole point of that book, Corporatism, to show that our consciousness, and I've got another book coming out. It's actually out now at progressivepress.com, but it hasn't hit, it's supposed to hit Amazon literally any
minute. Is that the telescreen?
Mm-hmm, yes. And that book is all about that consciousness and spirituality is absolutely controlled and destroyed. It's very, very sad.
Oh, I'd like a copy of that, too.
Yeah, I've got one. I'll get one to you, definitely.
Oh, great. And we'll have you on again to talk about these two and how they mesh with telementation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, telementation is our answer to all of our problems.
So we get the remedy first, and then this is better.
Absolutely. Fill yourself
it's much more hopeful, and then you can handle it, and in the process start transmuting it.
Mm-hmm.
And
a very simple, down-to-earth message from the heartland of America to actually change the whole ball of wax here. That's mm-hmm. great, Jeffrey. I'm inspired by talking with you.
Oh, thank you.
I know. So am I.
Well, that's good. I'm glad to hear it.
Unfortunately, we do have to wrap it up, though. We have another speaker coming on. It goes by so fast.
I really want to thank you for having me on.
You're welcome. Thank you for coming on. I have 3 hours a week, and I always think 3 hours, it's a lot of time. But it goes by so fast. I love it.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
All right.
Well, thank you so much, Jeffrey, and we will stay in touch, and I know there's a lot more.
Absolutely. Well, I'll just follow your lead. Whenever you're ready to have me on, I'd love to come on, and I'd like to say thank you to everybody in Santa Cruz for listening to us today.
Yes. All right. Thank you.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Wow.
Please enter the number you wish to dial.
That always happens. I have to learn to turn that off right away. Now we're going to listen to, I hope, a little bit of Lal. Let's see what we can get on here.
It's not new. The U.S. government.
You have dialed an invalid number. Please enter the number you wish to...
That happens at least once a show. It's part of the mix.
This is Russ from Good Riddance.
I believe we have Lal on now. Thank you, and we're going to be speaking with Professor Ken Kramer about Martin Buber, The I and Thou, and Mystical Dialogue. Stay tuned.
Jigar dari da hoon, jaake jigar ki baat suno, umeed
Was Law, a wonderful Pakistanian group. And with us now is Professor Ken Kramer from San Jose State University, and we're going to be talking about dialogic mysticism and the absolute person. And actually, he knows Thomas quite well, so I'm going to let Thomas introduce Dr. Kramer.
Thank okay, you. Kenneth Kramer. I know.
Thomas.
It's good to hear your voice.
There he is.
So I'll sing your praises here. PhD, doctorate in religion and culture from Temple University, and professor emeritus from San Jose State. Actually, a Santa Cruz resident, not native, however. And let's see if I can get this right. A pathway from Buddhism to Catholicism to Buberism, and
you left out the American Baptist roots, and those American Baptists wouldn't be happy to hear that.
Well, we got to start at the American Baptist roots, and
I like this man.
Yes, and also just Ken, in my knowing of you, you're one of the most positive people that I know in the face of some challenging circumstances, and that in and of itself is laudable and also something to emulate. So
thank you.
There I would say is a good introduction.
Mm-hmm.
And we talked a little bit on the phone last night, and you were going to discuss genuine dialogue and the between.
Yes.
And then personal impact, praying dialogically, and then some of the books that you've published quite extensively, World Scriptures, An Introduction to Comparative Religions, Death Dreams, Unveiling Mysteries of the Unconscious Mind, then The Sacred Art of Dying, How World Religions Understand Death, and then most recently, I think it's Martin Buber's I and Thou, Practicing Living Dialogue, which I'm real curious about, and then Redeeming Time, T.S. Eliot's Four Quarters. Where do we begin?
Four quartets.
Sorry.
Well, no. Well, we begin.
I can't read my
clearly
writing.
With Martin Buber, and we, of course, we can begin with the question: Why Martin Buber?
Yes.
And if you would like, I could begin right there.
Great. Please.
Okay. Well, so Martin Buber, born in, so long ago, it seems. Anyway, born in 1878, died in 1965.
Wow.
Born in Vienna.
Long life.
Highly educated. He knew 9 languages. He was an avid reader, writer. He was a professor himself, taught in various universities through Germany, and then left Germany just prior to Hitler, of course, and relocated into Jerusalem and spent the rest of his life in Jerusalem. He published himself over 30 books. Several of the things that he's best known for. One is his translation, along with Rosenzweig, another German scholar, his translation of the Hebrew Bible, the Jewish Bible, from Hebrew into German, which took him more than 25 years of his life. He was working on that, and it remains a monumental classic to this day of, again, translated into High German, so it's quite a masterpiece. And then he was also extremely well-known for his work on Hasidic spirituality.
So is that
Hasidic? I say Hasidism, I'm talking about 18th century Eastern European. This grew up in the Polish ghettos and lasted for about 6 generations and then died out. So I'm not talking about the Hasidism of today. And he collected and arranged and retold many of the Hasidic tales, which are published in several volumes. And so he's also well known for that. Having said all of that, he's even better known for his monumental classic, 1923 book, I and Thou,
yes.
Ich und Du, and to which he added a postscript in 1957, in which he explained, in which he addressed some of the questions which over the 40-year interval had been arising over and over again, and he added about 16 or 17 pages in which he address some of those questions. So, Martin Buber, interestingly enough, by the way, just to get a little bit of the gossip about Buber in, he, while being raised an Orthodox Jew, he never practiced Orthodox Judaism. He considered himself very religious in a spiritual sense, but he never, was a synagogue-going Jew. He married, in his early 20s, a Catholic woman, Paula Winkler, and she converted to Judaism for him, and they had 2 children. And he says in some of his writings that his whole philosophy of dialogue would have never come to fruition without her. In other words, she was the inspiration. She was the bedrock. She was the collaborator with him, and she was a writer herself, published poems and stories. But he attributed to her some of his success.
Oh, well, Thomas brought in a copy of your book, I and Thou, Martin Buber's I and Thou,
right? Practicing Living Dialogue.
And could we get started in practice?
Practice and practicing dialogue? We could get started.
Or just a little bit of what it is, first of all, and then...
Sure. Okay. Buber made a distinction early on between monologue and dialogue. So monologue being when I'm speaking to you, say, but I have an agenda... I have a point of view which I unswervingly hold to, and so even though you also speak to me, I really don't pay much attention to it, or I act like I'm paying attention to it, but I judge it, I associate other things with it, and I dismiss it. So monologue disguised as dialogue. And this is what, unfortunately, many people do much of the time mm-hmm. when they are not fully present.
Mm-hmm.
When they are thinking of something else while the other person's speaking, when they are remembering, oh, they have to get home early, take care of the kids, doing this, or whatever it is, whatever distracts us from really being present with the other person.
Downloading a show.
Yeah, okay, there you go.
At the moment, but not right now.
Okay. Well, so this he called monologue disguised as dialogue. Now, in contrast to that is what he means by genuine dialogue. Genuine dialogue, when I am open, when I am direct, when I am honest, and when I fully turn to the other person with my whole being, when I fully turn to the other person and engage that person in an address response mode such that I listen carefully, so carefully that I practice what Buber called inclusion, by which he means swinging over to the other side of the relationship and experiencing what the other person is experiencing, feeling what the other person is feeling, thinking what the other person is thinking, and then coming back to your side of the relationship and allowing all of that to shape and influence the way in which you respond to that person. Now, this we call that today, we would call that practicing empathy, let's say. Buber didn't like the use of the word empathy because he felt it was a little too one-sided. And inclusion to him was more of a two-sided mm-hmm. word. And as we get into this, you'll see that he is very, very adamant about this, being careful about this distinction between practicing living in a one-sided way mm-hmm. where you are an individual contained within your own individuality mm-hmm. and not willing to fully open up to the other in such a way so that the other actually influences you such that the other is able to help you to reshape even the way in which you think of something. So the difference between one-sided activity and two-sided activity. Well, for Buber, he was all about the relational component of dialogue, about being two-sided, about really listening carefully and attentively on the one hand, and then genuinely responding in a responsible way on the other hand. So genuine dialogue for him was one of the cardinal principles of his entire philosophy, and I must say this right away, Buber was not just a philosophical thinker. He also was someone who lived it, who walked it, who not only taught it, but who practiced it himself mm-hmm. in every moment. And
he embodied it.
Yeah, he embodied it, exactly. Good word.
And isn't there a third component in genuine dialogue?
Thomas, you see, that's
he's taking your class.
That's brilliant of you, and there's a good listener right there.
Because, oh, he is. He
you're
always
referring, I think, to at one point when I said in talking about genuine dialogue, and oh well, here. So let's say someone has really all of a sudden gotten interested in this conversation. And then let's say that whoever that person is out there, and you know who you are, who has suddenly just, ooh, really tuned into this conversation, check this out. In genuine dialogue, according to Buber, there aren't just two voices, but three voices. The voice of myself speaking, the voice of the other responding, And the third voice, which is the voice of the relationship itself, which voice is the voice of reciprocity, the voice of mutuality? Mm-hmm. It's the voice which, as it becomes thicker, meaning as it becomes more realized, as it becomes more, as each of the other two voices become more open to it and sensitive to it, it's the voice which actually directs the entire conversation when it's genuine.
Yeah.
And that, in my short form definition of dialogue, is when two people meet without agenda, affirm and confirm each other.
Mm-hmm.
That affirmation and confirmation,
yes,
actually creates a portal for the divine to enter into the relationship.
Well said.
Which could be the relationship itself, but is that in keeping with what you've been teaching in seminar?
Yes. Well, yes. Yeah. Let me tweak it a little bit and let me refine it a touch from Buberian standpoint. Now, what I am attempting to do, of course, can't be done. But what I'm attempting to do in this conversation with the two of you is to speak, to respond to your questions as if Martin Buber was sort of, you know, on my shoulder or behind me or encouraging me, so that I'm articulating as carefully as I can the way in which he would present this material. And what you just brought up, Thomas, is again one of the. I mean, Thomas, you don't mess around. You go right.
No, he doesn't.
You go right to the heart and soul of the matter, and you've once again you have plumbed very deeply into Martin Buber's philosophy of dialogue by bringing in the understanding that when it's genuine, that therein one glimpses presence of God. Now, a lot has to be said here. Mm-hmm. First of all, when Buber speaks that way, he says, be careful. In other words, when I say that every time you enter into a genuine relationship with whomever or whatever, it doesn't have to be with another person. It can be with a flower, can be with a tree, can be with a rock, can be with a horse, can be with the air, can be with the ocean, can be with, and so forth.
Absolutely.
Whenever you enter into a genuine relationship, meaning two-sided, a genuine relationship with whomever or whatever, therein one can glimpse, the presence of God. Now, in saying that, Buber says, to understand what I'm talking about here, you have to immediately forget everything that you think you understand about God, all of the prior teachings that you've ever learned about who God is.
Mm-hmm.
You have to let go of any ideas or imaginations or thoughts or understandings that you have about God, and simply listen to the voice of the relationship itself, such that when that voice strikes deeply in your soul, at that point you really are grasped by what it is that God is trying to communicate to you in that moment through the voice of the other. Because after all, as Buber says, after all, God communicates to us throughout all of God's creative order, through whether it's through nature, whether it's through art, whether it's through music, mm-hmm. whether it's through song or dance, or whether it's through what another person says. Whenever we are in a genuine relationship with any or all of the above, and a deep, within our heart of hearts, a chord is struck such that later on when we reflect back, that stays with us. Wow.
Mm-hmm.
This person said, wow, wow. What Thomas said to me the other day was so powerful. And it keeps recurring. Ah,
what was that?
That's God speaking through Thomas without Thomas even knowing it, because Thomas isn't on my side of the relationship in this moment. So he may not even be aware of that. And yet, I can be aware of the fact that, this is Thomas channeling God, so to speak. This is the presence of God. Now, again, another thing that one would have to understand.
Mm-hmm.
These are very important. I'm sorry to belabor all this, but
I can see it's essential.
It's very important to get the
foundation.
Exactly. That's all this is. This is preliminary and foundational. Okay.
Don't lose your thought, but I just have to throw in that Jeffrey Krupp, who was on just before you, was talking about reaching that point beyond words, essentially. Beyond words, that what he was trying to describe in a spiritual state was indescribable. It was beyond words, which is kind of what I just heard you say, and having to let go of all pre-knowledge or teachings, learnings of what God is before you can actually really even hear God.
Before you can hear God, and yet the only way to hear God is in and through words.
And there is the importance of reflection.
So it's not just abandoning the words or the language. It's, yes, admitting that the words and the language and all the baggage associated with it and all of the limitations and finitude associated with it can never, ever get at who God is, of course. And yet at the same time, it's one of the only vehicles we have. And therefore, and good, that gets me right to the point. So when Buber in 1957 added the postscript to I and Thou, now in 1923 he talked in the original I and Thou, he called God the eternal Thou, the Thou who is eternally coming to meet me, the Thou who is eternally standing over and against me. In fact, he said, God as eternal Thou needs me as much as or more than I need God. We all know how much we need God, Buber says. And then he says, but are you also aware of the fact that God needs you? What? Yes, to be God's partner in the creative and the redemptive process. To be a co-worker with God. In other words, the redemption of the world cannot be accomplished by God alone, nor can it be accomplished by humans alone, but only by the partnership between God and humans. All right, so all of that was in the original I and Thou. In 1957, then, Buber added another way of pointing to God, and he called God the absolute person. And this to me is one of those really breathtakingly brilliant moments in theological thinking through the ages, the way Buber puts this, points to God in this way. He says, although God is mysterium tremendum, beyond anything we could ever even begin to think of or imagine or understand and all of that. So who God is forever beyond the human mind, yet at the same time, because of God's love for each of us, God willingly takes upon God's self-limitation, coming into our realm from God's realm, which is, of course, infinite and unconditional and never-ending and all of that, and again, beyond anything we can understand, by placing that limitation on God's self, God takes on the role, the persona, one could say, of being the absolute person, as in, showing up in each and every moment of our lives, speaking directly to us through creation, through people, through art, through music, through animals, through our work, through whatever we're doing, if only and whenever we fully pay attention and are fully present to whomever we're with, whatever we're doing. So God becomes absolute person for us in order to communicate with us, in order to encourage us, but most of all, of course, in order to love us unconditionally and be loved by us. I mean, we can't love an abstract, infinite idea. We can only love concrete realities around us. And all of the concrete realities, the persons, our family members, our friends, nature, there are moments, forgive a little personal aside here, but and you mentioned earlier about praying dialogically, there are moments in my prayer, and I love praying by the beach, by the ocean, and there are moments as I'm praying, and I'm hearing the ocean, the lullaby of the ocean and the crashing of the ocean. In other words, all of the voices of the ocean, and I'm hearing all of those voices, and I'm aware that these are all voices of God. In the beginning, God said. So creation if you are a Jew or a Christian, creation comes about as a matter of God speaking. And so for Buber, the underneath side of every creative moment is God's voice speaking. So if you're right now, I'm looking out my window at a pine tree. There's a huge pine tree in the back of my yard. All right. So I'm looking at that pine tree, and it's stretching out magnificently. It's a tall, stately pine tree with long branches. And every day I look at that pine tree, and some days I see it, and sometimes I see the wind is blowing and the leaves and the branches are swaying back and forth. But sometimes I look at that pine tree, and that tree addresses me as a unique other, and I recognize that tree, for me, is addressing me with the voice of God. And I'm being at the ocean, and there are times when all of those voices, the voice of the surf and the voice of the crashing waves and the voice of children running on the beach and all of these different voices these are all voices of God, which are here, which are given to me as a gift, which continue to bring creation anew to me and hand it to me and say, here, Kenneth, here, now, what have you got? What have you got for me? You see, what have you got for me? I'm giving you all of this.
There's that reciprocity that you spoke about.
Reciprocity is the key.
Yeah.
Reciprocity is the key. Here is your gift.
Create the third.
And now here is my gift. And I respond.
And I believe that it's particularly in our age right now when so many of us have fallen asleep, so to speak, via TV or mass culture or just
stress.
Attachment to pain and suffering and stress. that call for what have you got for me? You know, what can I throw into the pot that will perhaps make somebody else's life better, easier, or more interesting, or just a little ray of sunshine, a smile. I mean, what can I do? And the idea of not necessarily some grandiose thing,
right,
but what's the smallest thing that
even
I can
a smile
do?
Or a sure. touch.
Sure. And for Buber, again, Buber was very fond of distinctions. Distinctions were very important for him because he wanted to make sure that that we weren't living in a world of collapsed distinctions, by which he means if you're going along in this walking sleep that you're referring to, part of the reason is because we're not aware of certain distinctions. We just accept things habitually over and over again.
Yeah.
And then, as Samuel Beckett wrote in his great play, Waiting for Godot, habit is the great deadener. So we become deadened. We become deadened by virtue of not making these distinctions.
And we fail to look at the tree and ask what its message is or what
its
witness.
What is that tree saying to me?
Walk by
what is it asking of me? What is it asking of me? At any rate, this distinction that I'm referring to now is a distinction between gnosis and devotio. Gnosis, on the one hand, is secret knowledge, the knowledge of the infinite spheres, the knowledge which will liberate you, emancipate you, and all of that, the knowledge. But for Buber, even though in his earlier years he was interested in that, when he was practicing a kind of unitive mysticism, he was interested in that kind of knowledge. But then he realized that, no, wait a minute, that's one-sided. I can have all of that realization and all of that knowledge and all of that amazing amazing secret awareness that I want, but that's all one-sided. And so the other side of that distinction between gnosis is devotio, and devotio means service. And this is a term right out of, well, Hebrew scriptures, right out of Hasidism, service.
Right out of Quaker trainings.
Right out of Quaker training.
Native traditions.
In Native America, it's everywhere. Service, meaning that you, all you have to do is you just, take a step, and whomever or whatever you see, how can I serve? What can I do? Where can I be of assistance? And so service is one of the great tools of reciprocity, and it's one of the great ways of responding to the gifts that are coming to us in every moment, that the creative order is offering all of us at every moment. And one way of responding then is through service. And as you said, Thomas, it doesn't have to be some great, grand, big thing. Back in 1963, a woman wrote me a letter. Not back in 1963. She wrote me a letter recently in terms of an event that happened back in 1963, when she with a graduate class from the University of Wisconsin, I believe, was honored to go to Jerusalem. And when they were in Jerusalem, because of somebody who was associated with this class, they were invited to go to visit Martin Buber in his home in Jerusalem.
My.
Now, in 1963, Buber is 83 years old, 84 years old. He only had a couple more years to live, and he invites all the people into his study. So now they're sitting, there are about 12 of them, they're sitting in his study, books line every wall from ground to floor. And Buber's at he's brought in, he's at his desk, venerable, with the warmest eyes. With the warmest eyes. And he said, he was just there to answer. He said, are there any questions? Different people had different questions. And just before the time was up for people to leave, somebody said, Herr Buber, could you tell me who are the great men of history?
Mm.
And immediately Buber responded, almost like a Zen master. And Buber responded and said, there are no great men, only useful ones. And you see, that's service.
Yeah.
Only useful ones, to be of service. So to get back then to what you were saying, Thomas, about that, yeah. And that service can be and is anything that you do that is for another, that helps another person along their way in whatever way it takes shape. So anything at all that you do unthinkingly and that you do without needing credit for, or that you do without needing to be noticed, or that you just do because it's who you are.
Mm-hmm.
Because of who you are, that says it all.
Well, there was I have a confession to make. I had somewhat of an agenda in asking you to be on the radio show, but I don't think it's anti-dialogical to have an agenda if you admit the agenda. Then it's out in the open. But the agenda was or is, I just feel that in my own life, to lessening extent all the time, even though external circumstances really haven't changed much, but there's just so many people that I observe are in stressful situations or in states of fear about what may transpire in their life. And my agenda then was to have you share with us some of the things to empower us in day-to-day living. And one, the thing that comes to my mind in that regard is what I've heard you refer to as a practice of hallowing the day.
Oh, I like that.
And how you do that, and is something that
sure.
may be a practice that other people may want to
sure.
Adapt or change to fit themselves.
Sure. Hallowing the everyday is a Hasidic term that comes out of Buber's study of Hasidism. The word hallowing itself, hallowed be thy name, is in the Jesus prayer. Hallowing means making holy or consecrating. So by practicing hallowing, which is something that I do as often as I can be conscious of it and have energy to do it, and as often as I'm graced to do it, hallowing means to recognize the sacred gift that life is, and that gift, which is continually giving of itself, of its own soul, to me, then invites me to reciprocate that gift with a gift of my own. Now, this is not just intellectual BS, because you alluded to my condition, so I'll just speak about it. So I have multiple sclerosis, and I've been I've had it for over 30 years, and recently it's gotten a little bit more debilitating in terms of the limitations that it places upon me. In fact, I walk very little and only with a walker and so forth, only go out once a day and all kinds of... So there are all kinds of severe limitations on my own life as a result of MS. And one of the things that helps me to cope with and I wouldn't say overcome, but I would say live with and alongside of that condition is to recognize it as a gift.
Hmm.
Now, this takes an enormous amount of bracketing of all the denial and all the negativity and all the resistance to that, to taking on that understanding that MS is a gift to me. I would have never chosen it. I would have never asked for it. Take it away from me, please. I don't want it. Mm. And yet, looking at the world through the eyes of MS has enormous consequences for me with regard to the way in which people relate to me, with regards to opportunities that show up for me that wouldn't show up in other ways, and with regards to the choices that I make in my life, which are far different from the choices I would have made had I been mobile and able to do all the things I used to do and all the rest of it. So what I'm suggesting is, in terms of anybody who is in whatever strata of life or in whatever the commotion is, Boober used to talk about commotion. Whatever the commotion is, there's commotion for all of us, commotion for me, commotion for all of us that wants to draw us away from and wants to distract us. T.S. Eliot says, distracted from distraction by distraction. Oh, yeah. So all of that commotion that distracts us, yeah, all right. Even that has to be seen as a gift. Even death has to be seen as a gift. So the point is, hallowing the everyday, the way that it works for me, to hallow or make holy mm-hmm. the everyday, is to recognize that everything that happens has a gift aspect to it, which then invites me to reciprocate with a gift of my own, whether that gift is service, to the extent that I can serve, whether that gift is speaking to you on the radio to the extent that I can do that, whether that gift is shutting up and keeping out of people's ways, which I have an awfully hard time doing, by the way, whatever that gift is, I'm constantly being asked as a hallower to reciprocate the enormous gifts that life continues to show up with and continues to hand me, so much so that it's embarrassing. I mean, utterly embarrassing to when I stop and think and when I pause in prayer, there are times when I say in my own puny and silly and immature and undeveloped way to the God who autographs all of this, and I say to God, look, dude, I can't even imagine loving you any more than I do, and yet I can imagine loving you more than I do because of the incredible amount of gifts that you keep bestowing upon me. And what in the world, how and why and all that, all I can do is ask for another one. And that next one is to continue to help me to recognize all the gifts that you're giving me, you see. So to continue that, to assist me in being as awake as I can be, although, come on, I'm sleeping through a lot of it, like just like, you know, we sleep through a lot of it, but still, keep me as awake as possible and alive as possible and alert as possible and as creative as possible and as serving as possible, and so that I can be of some kind of a inspiration to others, albeit in a puny way, but so it's that. So yeah, the hallowing is crucial for me, Thomas. And as you've heard me say, the only time I said I go out the house is one time in the morning. I drive out to the spa to swim, my mm-hmm. only exercise, and then come home. Well, on my way out to the club, my prayer practice then is, I once heard a Buddhist nun say, in response to a disciple said, "You keep talking about meditation. I don't have enough time to meditate. When am I supposed to meditate?" And the Buddhist nun said, "You waste so much time without even realizing it. Look, when you get in the car, don't turn the radio on. Meditate." And I thought about that, and I thought, whoa, there it is. For so many years, we get in the car and turn on whatever, the radio, and listen to whatever, sports talk or music or whatever. No. Get in the car. Now my practice is I get in the car, I turn on the radio and listen to a couple words and then turn it off. The whole point is turning it. I turn it on in order to turn it off. I make that conscious decision to turn it off. And then as I drive out to the club, I pray. And my prayer is a version of God, Holy One, please allow me and assist me in framing this entire day in your way, so that whatever happens today, it's going to all come from you. And I'm going to be as open to it as possible and aware of it as possible, and keep me attentive to and listening, because it's your day, and I want your will to be done. I want your kingdom to come, and I want to be a part of it. I want to participate in it. I want to help out as much as I can. But I know it's your game here. I know you're the man, and so you're the woman. Help me, therefore, to walk through that frame, that divine, sacred frame of hallowing every day, of seeing everything as holy, of recognizing that everything is a gift being given to me. Help me to walk through that frame, and then as things occur to me, to respond appropriately. Well, that's hallowing the everyday for me, and that's a way of reciprocating the gift of creation, which continues to be more breathtaking than it was a few moments ago when I said it was breathtaking. Well, it's even more breathtaking.
As opposed to seeing everything as ordinary and of no sacred value. It's all sacred.
Right. And as opposed to being one-sided.
Yes.
Being two-sided. You see, it's not a matter, again, of gnosis. It's not a matter of realization, awareness, knowledge. It's not a matter of, I've got to train myself to see everything as sacred. No. No, it's not that at all. It's Kramer, as God is your partner, as God is your co-pilot, so to speak, you become partner with whomever, whatever you meet. You become a partner with whomever or whatever you meet to the extent that it's appropriate, to the extent that the other is open, to the extent that the other is willing, to the extent that you are able, you, just as God is your partner, you become a partner too. Here you go. Martin Buber's basic insight. Okay, at the end of his life, or toward the end of his life, he was asked, as you look back over everything that you've done, is there a common thread, or is there something that that runs through it all? And he said, yes. And he said, the basic insight which undergirds everything that I've written, everything that I've taught, the way in which I live my life is as follows. The relationship between persons, when genuine, is deeply connected, deeply bonded to the relationship between persons and God. So there's a two-directional reciprocity between my relationship with you, with the world, on the one hand, when it's genuine. Simultaneously, there occurs my relationship with the holy other. Simultaneously. So those two relationships, you could say, since we're visual people, or since I am, the horizontal connection and the vertical connection, even though I'm not saying God is up there and whatever, whatever. God's everywhere, of course. But even though when we visualize things, we say, okay, God above and humans below, all right. Well, the horizontal line that connects us to each other in genuine relationship at every point is intersected by the vertical connection between ourselves and God, again, when that relationship is genuine. So there's this two-directional reciprocity occurring all the time, all the time. And, of course, most of the time, we're not aware of or ready for it.
That's there's a couple. There's a number of different things going through my mind. That was very beautiful.
Yes,
that's the primary one. The two-directional reciprocity. Thank you for helping pronounce that word.
Or two-directional mutuality, same thing, yeah.
Okay, maybe I'll leave that next time. But what I was thinking of is that Buber's, that seems very profound to me, because my understanding of where Martin Buber started out was in this mysticism, almost a mysticism that was beyond the world.
Yes.
And
otherworldly mysticism. You're right. No, otherworldly mysticism.
And then at some point of his life, he came back and decided that the real way, or the next real way, to interface with the creative force of the universe, i.e. God, was to pay attention to the people around him.
And you know what happened? It happened in 1914, and it happened when a young man came to visit Buber in Germany, 1914, and this was at the outbreak of World War I, and this young man came to visit Buber, and Buber said, I was attentive as usual, and I made the young man feel comfortable, and I offered him whatever, and I listened to him, and yet a part of me was still hung over, so to speak, was still remaining in my morning of mystical reverie.
Oh.
A part of me was still in rapture of the unitive consciousness of the world soul, in which everything is manifest in that oneness. All right. So that was, a part of me was still there. And so, even though I was attentive, and even though, or as much as I could be, and even though we had a nice conversation, and then the young man excused himself, and then he left, and he went off to the war. A little while later, Buber heard through a friend of this young man's that he had been killed at the front of the war. He had been killed. He had been killed as the result of not being able to resist his own death. And Buber right away felt judged. He felt judged because he recognized that when that young man had come to see him, even though he didn't say it, his unexpressed concern or question was, what should I be doing with my life? And Buber never got to that, which he would have had he been, again, practicing inclusion, swinging over to the other side and then bringing the experiences and the thoughts and the fears and the feelings back to his side. He might have been able to help that young man express that unexpressed question and then and responded to it in such a way that might have redirected the young man's life totally.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Buber felt judged by that, and he said, since then, I have given up, or rather, it has given me up, the understanding of religion being something separate or something different or something out of this world or whatever. And I know only the every concrete moment's demand and claim on me to act responsibly. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
That's it.
That was a key moment.
And that was the key moment for him. And that was 1914. And then he, by 1923, he published I and Thou, which of course is his the breakthrough, the breakout into genuine dialogue. Yeah. Yeah.
But, and if we,
yes.
And if we could all be so conscious.
No. Thomas, let me interrupt you. No.
Oh, go ahead.
If I could be so conscious.
Well, yeah.
This has nothing to do with all.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Thank you for that correction. I guess what comes to me when you talk that is one day I was working and I happened to look at my shadow, and then I realized that that's the sunlight coming from millions of miles away, casting my shadow. And I was in the midst of some fairly mundane labor, and I realized that even the mundane labor was a miracle based upon the fact that I was lit by the sun and powered by the sun, and that every moment is a miracle.
Yeah.
And this moment, sadly or not sadly, we get to say goodbye. And
oh my goodness, we just
it went by so fast.
Well, but and you see, it there does. It is. Genuine when dialogue is genuine, it's timeless.
Yeah,
it's timeless because you're
that's
not,
how it felt.
You're not aware. You're not being divided off into the commotion that time brings. Mm-hmm. Oh my God, I've got to do this now. Anyway,
no.
Anyway, very nice. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, and for the opportunity to more deeply reflect.
Thank you, Ken.
I appreciate it, and thanks for the opportunity. And be well, and be dialogical.
Bless you. I'll see you in the future.
Yes, indeed. Bless you both. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Well, that was Ken Wilber.
Ken Kramer.
Oh,
a native Santa Cruzan.
Native professor at San Jose State, comparative religion. We learned so much about dialoguing as if where Martin Buber were on our shoulder.
And if I dare say.
In the subtleties, the distinctions.
I dare say one of the local, maybe minor, maybe major saints, hallowing the day.
I think, yeah, he's quite a resource. Beautiful.
Bless you all.
Bless you all. Now we have Palestinian news, I believe. Let's see. There it is. Thank you for listening.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Thursday, February 11th, 2010. Two Palestinians reported killed in the Gaza Strip as the army steps up attacks in the West Bank. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned.